Coming up on today's three-hour BPR, to authorize or not authorize war, that is the question. As Britain's parliament debates the issue, our Congress is home campaigning. We'll ask your reaction to our do-nothing Congress continuing to do nothing, even when it comes to war. Then Globe editor Brian McGorry on our governor as AG and upcoming gubernatorial debates, some with five candidates, some with two. Then in Hollywood fashion, Derek Jeter hits the game winner in his final at bat at Yankee Stadium. Dan Shaughnessy reviews a legendary career. Then we'll ask you if you'll cheer number two in pinstripes this weekend.
Emily Rooney with a famous list of gripes and complaints. This week she even complains about her intro music. Then our Friday news quiz featuring a husband and wife team of gypsy brewers. They're brewing one of the hottest new beer brands around. All that coming up on Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH. Rowdy, I am Marjorie Egan. This is day five of our new three-hour edition, 11 to 2 of Boston Public Radio. We're glad you're with us. We are at 89.7 WGBH. Hey, Jim.
Hey, Marjorie. How are you?
Good, thank you.
So today, while most of America was sleeping and our congressional leaders were both literally and figuratively sacked out, here's what was going down in the House of Commons.
The threat of radicalization is already here. Young people have left our country to go and fight with these extremists. We must take action at home. But we must also have a comprehensive strategy to defeat these extremists abroad.
That is British Prime Minister David Cameron, again, speaking this morning. He's been urging Parliament to approve plans to join the U.S. military campaign in Iraq. And he doesn't just want their support, he needs their support. But some members of Parliament apparently are not sold. Here is George Galloway, also this morning.
The mission creep hasn't even waited for the end of the debate. The words on the motion are about bombing Iraq. If there's a consensus in here that we're going to soon be bombing Syria, the words don't mention boots on the ground, but there's a consensus here that there will be boots on the ground.
So a healthy and important public debate in the UK. How is it that our president can and is bypassing congressional support to wage war on Iraq? Or does he need it at all? We're going to get your reaction to Congress's inaction in a couple of seconds. But first, joining us on the line to untangle the congressional issue is about President Obama getting authority to wage war on the Islamic State is Elizabeth Spaun. She's an expert in congressional law, professor of law emerita at New England Law, Boston. Professor Spaun, thanks so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
So, Professor, can you give us the arguments in terms we'll all understand on both sides for getting the congressional approval and not getting it?
There are competing views that the president has the authority inherently, either as part of his commander-in-chief authority or his duty to defend the United States. And so in that view, the president does not need any congressional authorization where there's a direct threat to the United States. The prevailing view is that Congress has an explicit constitutional power to declare war, and that this would include, in situations that are not emergencies, this would include the power and the duty to declare war or other shorter, less than full war authorizations for the use of military force.
Professor, you are an expert at this. What do you think? Which side is right?
I don't know. It seems to me that we have historical problem with the use of military force.
Professor, we're going to put you on hold 1 second. We've got a horrible connection, and we're going to try to get you back in 15 seconds. Just sit tight. It's Professor Spaun again, professor of law emerita at New England Law School. And what we're going to do, just so you understand what the next few minutes is going to be like, after we hear from the professor about the legal arguments on both sides, if you want to weigh in on whether or not Congress the president is required to seek congressional authorization to do what he's doing and continue doing what he's doing. He says it's going to go on for years. We'd like that. But we're much more interested in is, as a citizen of this country, how you feel about the fact that our Congress, even if they don't, he doesn't need their authorization, is home campaigning, raising money, not debating these issues, debating whether they do need authorization, debating whether or not ground troops should be part of this discussion, debating the whole wisdom of airstrikes on ISIS and Khorasan in Iraq and Syria as is being done in the UK, as I say, as we speak earlier this morning.
Well, I hope we get Professor Spahn back on a better line, because that's the big question I want to ask her is, okay, we're doing the airstrikes now, but if we do advance and there is this mission creep that the gentleman in Parliament was worried about, and we are talking about troops on the ground, a term I'm really beginning to hate, troops on the ground, whether the arguments are the same.
Well, troops on the ground, by the way, I should just say, is a lot better than boots on the ground. One of our listeners emailed last week and said, and I thought it was Sheila, as a matter of fact, made a wonderful point, is that boots on the ground allows one to dehumanize the whole thing. It's sort of like we're not putting your sister, your brother, your husband, your wife, your kid in harm's way. And by the way, we do have people in harm's way. We have people who are these military advisors who can be shot on, but they're not there formally for combat. In any case, we have Professor Spahn back on the line. Professor, you with us?
I think so.
Great.
Oh, that sounds much better.
Is that better? Good.
You were in the middle of saying you're not sure who's right. Do you want to elaborate on that a little bit, please?
Well, I think it's really complicated. We have the question of the legal authorization has been an ongoing problem really since John Adams, since the XYZ affair, where Congress authorized the use of military force. And there have been about 35 instances over our history where Congress has authorized military force. Sometimes they're very specific about the geography or the time. Congress allows the president to use specific methods of other times, like the 2001 authorization, which President Obama is apparently claiming under. It's indeterminate. We don't have a specific geography. We don't have a specific time frame. It's a general authorization. And if President Obama's interpretation or his presumed interpretation is that it's a complete authorization forever, arguably that's an unconstitutional delegation of Congress's war power.
You know, Professor, you said that the two arguments the president could use to defend his position, that he says things like, I want Congress's support and involvement, and obviously he got them to vote to approve arming and training Syrian rebels, which is a whole separate issue. He is not using this Commander-in-Chief Article II power, and obviously he's not using it because he used to criticize George Bush for using it. He is talking about this Afghanistan authorization in 01, the Iraq authorization in 02, but you use the words that the Pentagon is using, the duty to defend. My understanding is that it's about duty to defend us, not what he's saying, the duty to defend Iraq. How can he possibly make the argument that the duty that he sees to defend the country of Iraq is covered by what happened 11, 12, 13 years ago?
I think that's a really excellent point, Jim. I think that's really the key matter, the heart of the matter here. The Pentagon is talking in terms of an implicit duty to defend that extends beyond the borders of the United States or U.S. persons abroad or property abroad, which would be a huge expansion. I don't believe President Obama's spokespeople have gone that far. They're, I think, primarily relying on the 2001 and 2002 authorizations that involve Iraq and Afghanistan.
Professor Spahn, while we were getting the better line, I was asking the question that I think a lot of regular old citizens like myself are worried about. If the president were to send, I mean, we know he has, there are people there already surreptitiously, intelligence gathering, et cetera. But if they were to send troops over to Iraq and Syria, and there were actual more American troops, would these arguments about the constitutionality be the same or different?
I think if they send troops in large numbers, I think the special operations, the smaller forces, are probably not a problem. But if they send larger numbers of soldiers and sailors, the War Powers Resolution clearly kicks in at that point and would require some kind of congressional authorization or approval within 60 or 90 days, depending on the actions.
Yeah, Professor Spahn, last thing for me. It sounds like beyond understanding the law, you're a bit of a congressional historian. We all know, we don't need to know much to know that when you run for president, you say the president is overstepping his authority. When you become president, obviously the president has the authority. But that's not what I'm interested in. In past situations, what I'm upset about, because you say it may be a close question. For those who believe that it's a close question in good faith, I respect that. What I don't respect is that Congress is essentially on vacation while we're beginning a war. Through history, even when Congress has not voted to authorize action like this, are they usually out of session Or at least are they meeting and debating and discussing the issues, essentially like the House of Commons does? Do you know the answer to that question?
I think this is really important. If we're going to retain the power with the people, with the representatives of the people in Congress, before we loose the dogs of war, Congress has to step up here, step up to the plate. I think there's an inherent momentum in the presidency to take these actions, to expand. I think any executive officer expands their power as far as they can. It's natural. But Congress really needs to step up here. And I would urge Congress to consider a specific authorization for the current bombing and military campaign against ISIS. If Congress would work out some kind of specific authorization that was not relying on a 13-year-old vague, it's ludicrous to claim that the 2001 authorization should be is extending this far. We need a new authorization from Congress, and only if Congress will step up and do their duty can we preserve the constitutional limitations on the president's war powers.
Amen.
Okay, reading between the lines here, the professor's with you, Jim. She thinks that they're a bunch of do-nothings that should get back there and do their job. Thank you.
Professor, good to speak to you.
Thank you so much for being with us, Professor Spong. We really appreciate it.
My pleasure.
I wanted just to say, Professor Spong, people know who she is and where she's from. She's a professor of law emerita at New England Law School. Again, she was great, and thank you for joining us. We're going to open up the lines now to you guys at 877-301-8970, 877-301-8970. What do you think? Do we rewrite the law so that congressional leaders have to give the president authorization to go to war instead of spending the month fundraising and on the campaign trail? Would you prefer that they were all in D.C. working together to change our current war resolutions?
I want to make my position clear here. If you want to debate the whole constitutional issue, that's fine. Neither of us are constitutional lawyers. Most of you probably aren't either. But it's fine if you have strong feelings about it. I want to step back and return to the issue that I raised with Professor Spawn at the end. Even if you are of the mind, like the president is, that there is no need for a congressional authorization, what is your reaction to the fact that members of Congress and their leaders don't care enough to even be in session when we essentially have begun a war, no matter what you call it, forget the semantics, we've begun a war, re-begun a war in Iraq and Syria, and they're home campaigning, raising money. To me, it is an abject failure to do your jobs. 877-301-8970. Go and debate. Debate the authorization in power or lack of power. Debate the question of ground troops. Debate Congress's role. Do something to represent our point of view. They are, I hate to be rhetorical, they're the people's representatives in the United States, in the United States Capitol.
Christopher just sent an email with his analysis. He says, I believe in the case of the do-nothing Congress, we create our own reality or get what we pay for, in a sense. What percent of us voted in the recent primary elections? We do nothing. They do nothing. They are us. That is a good point, the sense that Americans are very disengaged. You may be scared about ISIS and scared about this this Al-Qaeda group that is planning, allegedly, Coruscant, these terrible plots against subways here and abroad, et cetera. But we are somewhat disengaged.
Yeah, we are disengaged, and we're modeling after the people who represent us in Washington. By the way, the best line I've heard, I may have said this the other day, Jack Kingston is a Republican congressperson from Georgia. He's about to lose a seat because he ran for the Senate in the primary and lost. He said, here's the attitude in this building. Just bomb the place and tell us about it later.
Oh, that's a great line.
And that's not everybody. Yeah. I mean, it surely is not. And we'll play you in a couple of minutes the sound of a congressperson on our show the other day who feels that the president ultimately does need a congressional authorization. But when Barack Obama stands up and says, this will continue for years, again, forget the Constitution for a second. The fact that our representatives are not debating this and discussing this is appalling to me.
And you know what else? Haven't they filed this lawsuit against the president, members of Congress, about his abuse of power?
Executive power, correct.
So here they filed this lawsuit about abuse of power. He seems to be off on his own, waging this war, if you want to call it a war. And as somebody else has said, where's Congress? They've taken a powder.
Really, and so by the way, everybody knows why that is. For those who are sitting there who are slightly dissonant, the reason is because they didn't want to vote on a tough issue prior to midterm elections. I don't think they ever want to vote on it. The majority, I'm not talking about, there are some very principled And by the way, one of the people who thinks they have to vote, Dick Durbin, who is essentially the mentor of Barack Obama, the senior senator from Illinois, at the same time that Barack Obama was the junior senator from Illinois. So we'll take your calls, 877-301-8970. I am worked into a total frenzy over this.
Wow. Why should today be any different?
I know, but again, it's not even the constitutional issue. It's the basic notion. And one last thing. We mentioned the other day, Senator Mikulski. She at least debated this thing in an empty Senate chamber the other day during the vote on the arming and training the Syrian rebels to the tune of $500 million. What was the content of her debate, Marjorie?
I think she talked all about her hometown baseball
team. Baltimore Orioles. 7 minutes on the Baltimore Orioles. Let's go to...
And she was dressed in team colors
Is that
well.
True?
Yes,
she was. You're right.
Was.
Let's start with Bill in Sudbury. You're first on Boston Public Radio. Thank you very much for the call, Bill. Hi.
Hi. Jim, you are so right that the slick avoidance that actually, they didn't avoid it. They scheduled the vote for January. So the slick avoidance of Congress is absolutely shameful. You are so right about that.
Yeah, you do. The contrast between us and the Brits on this, you know, you have to love watching the Parliament. You see them on TV. They're all yelling and screaming at each other. I mean, it's a very kind of free-for-all deal. And compare that to when you talked about Mikulski being there having the debate before. The chamber,
empty chamber.
Was empty on many occasions, Bill.
Well, you know, Bill, it also goes further. As mentioned, I hope some people either watch this morning, as I was, some of the debate in the House of Commons, or you know, go online and watch it. You know what? You know how it works there. That essentially, the Prime Minister takes his position, and then a member of Parliament gets up, usually impolitely, and challenges a position. And you know who has to respond to it? Not another member of the party of the Prime Minister. The Prime Minister himself
and also,
stands up and responds to the questions raised by his colleagues.
And they boo and they hiss.
No, I'll tell you. It is. But by the way, that, to me, that is the essence of small-D democracy. Bill, thanks. I'm sorry.
I don't think the president is held hostage while Congress dithers either. I think he's allowed to proceed and they can catch up later.
Well, and by the way, that's under the World War Powers Act. That's what a lot of people think after whatever it is, 60 or 90 days. Well, then they should assert that power. He's initiating this thing. But when he says it's going to take years and years, it's time for these men and women to stand up and do their jobs. Thanks for the call, Bill.
Margaret from Weymouth. What do you think, Margaret?
Hi. First of all, I love your show.
Thanks.
And thank
I love
you.
Hearing, I love hearing both of you.
Thanks.
I mean, it's really refreshing.
Thank
it's
you.
Refreshing to
thank
hear
you,
the two
you.
Of you. Now, I am confused of an like an overall issue about how do you get informed? How does a citizen get informed to even know how to make a decision or the answer to your question? You know, should Congress be involved? President doing the right thing. How do we get our information? How do we trust our
That's
media
great.
Sources?
Well, you know, Margaret, though, there is a comforting answer, to, at least to some degree. If we were going to have a debate, you could actually watch it yourself on C-SPAN. You could see one side presenting their point, the other side presenting their point, and you'd at least feel you were hearing both sides. Although, having just said that, I remember that one of the things that reassured me back when we invaded Iraq the second time around, not with Bush, the first at Bush the second.
Say.
I used to watch Tony Blair.
Oh,
well, you're
going
to say
Colin Powell.
Yeah.
Well,
Colin Powell convinced me that he knew what he was talking about. Turns out he was not, well, cooking the books, I guess it's fair to say at this point. But I was comforted by Tony Blair, who was saying this was the right thing to do. I thought, well, maybe George Bush doesn't know everything, but Tony Blair is back there too. But then Tony Blair turned out to be wrong, so I guess you can watch him and still not know.
Well,
him.
Yeah, Margaret,
so,
We're overwhelmed. Margaret, I have much better advice for you than Marjorie's. I'm sorry. What you should do is go online, watch the 7-minute tribute to the Baltimore Orioles from Senator Mikulski during the debate on the Syrian resolution. That gives you. I mean, the answer, Margaret, it's a wonderful question. And the answer, you know, you should do what we do. You know, what we did this morning with our colleagues. We went and read editorials in favor of Congress, of the president needing congressional authorization, and those who say the president is right. And then you decide where you fall. Margaret, thanks for a great call, and thanks for the kind words. We really appreciate it.
Well, then there's also the existential question, which is, should we be getting in there at all? I mean, a lot of people think that we are just – that this is just an endless quagmire, that you know, the Rand Paul place, that, you know, these old barnacled, crusty old – you know, chicken hawks have never seen a war they didn't like, and our sons and daughters should not be over there fighting. These people should be fighting for themselves. The Iraqis, the Syrians, solving their own problems. I mean, that's another.
Well, you know who called this the beginning, entering a quagmire? Someone we both respect,
yes,
the intellect
Frank,
of a lot. Frank Rich,
Frank
formerly
Rich,
the New York
formerly
Times.
New York. Boy, he's disappeared since he left the New York Times.
Well, not in New York City, in New York Magazine.
Yeah,
in any case,
that's sort of disappearing, I think. Absolutely, we're going to continue this conversation in just a minute. We're going to hear from two congressmen. We talked to one on this show, one on Jim's show, actually, with opposite views on what we should be doing. Stay tuned for that in 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio, Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan. We're talking about the whole notion that at the same time that the House of Commons and Parliament in Great Britain is debating whether or not to give authorization for the British government to participate in airstrikes in Iraq, not in Syria, it's limited to Iraq, our Congress is home. And there are really two issues. One is, does the president constitutionally need a congressional authorization? And by the way, you'll hear from two congresspeople in about 30 seconds who have different opinions. I think people of goodwill can disagree. What it's hard for me to believe that anybody can disagree with is that members of Congress, when we're beginning a war that could last years, according to our president, are home campaigning, or if they don't have opponents, home just raising money or vacationing, as opposed to debating these issues. A couple of days ago, Michael Capuano, congressman, represents Boston Somerville, was with us on Tuesday, said the president will need to come to Congress soon to get authorization to continue the strikes. Congressman Lynch, also from Boston, South Boston, was with us the other day, also with me last night. This is from last night on television, said the president could continue for months without authorization if necessary. Here they are.
I think he needs an authorization at some point. I think he has the authorization to do what he needs to do in the short term.
Going back to 2003, the Iraq authorization for the use of military force does cover al-Qaeda and its affiliates. And so he does technically have the authority to use force.
Two smart people of goodwill who have different opinions, and both of whom said to us or to me that they believe that Congress should be in session in the middle of this, at least debating the issues, including, by the way, Congressman Lynch, who doesn't even think he needs the authorization of Congress.
ISIS is not an affiliate of al-Qaeda.
What are you talking about?
That's what Lynch just said. He is authorized from 2003 to go after al-Qaeda and its affiliates.
Well, he was mentioning Khorasan. He was talking about the Khorasan thing in that case.
That's one of the points that people make that don't like this.
No, but in all fairness, that did characterize his position. It was a 10-minute discussion. We just took 10 seconds from it. 877-301-8970. Are you comfortable with a Congress that most people don't have much respect for staying home? Some people may think, listen, the less they have to do with it, the better it is. Or do you want them to be engaged, even if you don't want them to formally have the final word on authorization of these airstrikes? 877-301-8970 is our number.
Now, Margaret just called, asked how to decide.
Yeah.
A big fan of yours, Jim. Well, Art just emailed and said, right, this is how you decide. Listen to Boston Public Radio, watch Broadside, and then take the opposite position
I think
from
that's,
Jim.
That's actually a pretty sane position. Let's go to Fitchburg, where Michael is on the phone. Michael, you're next on Boston Public Radio. Thanks much for the call. Hi.
Hi, how are you?
We're excellent, thank you.
That's good. I just caught up in the, I was listening to what you were saying about Congress, and I mean, Congress is obviously an adversary, especially the House of Representatives, and they really don't want to get involved. Anything that Barack Obama says, they're against, or they do nothing. And also...
By the way, before you continue, Michael, a greater percentage of Republicans voted with the president on his proposal to arm and train Syrian rebels than did Democrats. So when it comes to war and foreign policy, that what you described that is normally the case is not always the case. But go ahead.
Well, that's fine. They like to go to war. And they spent, my son was over in Afghanistan and in Iraq, and mm-hmm. he was in military intelligence, and he just recently got out. And he never talks about anything, but... I asked him straight up, I says, then is this predictable? He says, yeah. He says, 18 months ago, they were given information, sending it up the ladder, and he says they don't want to hear that, and now here it comes to fruition, and everyone's talking about sending people back over again. And,
well, you know, yeah, Michael, I don't know if you're Leon Panetta the other night, former chief of staff to Bill Clinton, was on 60 Minutes and made the point that one of the reasons we're in this mess is because we got out too soon, as many critics of the president, and Panetta is not one, have been want to say. Michael, thank you for the call. We appreciate it.
John from Somerville. What do you think, John?
Hey, John.
Hey. Well, I called the other day about the Ray Rice thing, and it's good to see you're up in arms again about something, Jim. I know how much you enjoy that. From one curmudgeon before his time to another. You know, I sympathize with your frustration. But I think that in a democracy, you're constantly fighting the fact that no one wants to take responsibility for anything. Mm. So it's very typical of a legislature to want to get out of making a decision. And I think that ordinary people have to take a certain amount of responsibility for this, too. So, you know, we can be up in arms about Congress refusing to, you know, schedule a vote and being absent. But ultimately, we should vote them all out. What we've done instead is increase the incentives for constant campaigning, for constant politicking, and that's on us.
John, I could not agree with every single word more.
John, you raise a great point, because you don't get the sense that we're all writing to our congresspeople or calling their offices or emailing and saying, where the heck are you? Why aren't you down there discussing this? You don't get the sense that we're engaged. I mean, Christopher said that at the beginning. People hardly even voted in the primaries. And they're expected not to be voting in great numbers either in the upcoming gubernatorial race. So part of it is on us. We are.
But I mean, look at Martha Coakley. You were just saying yesterday how, you know, she's taking a lot of criticism, I think fairly, for basically constantly saying, oh, well, I'm open to that.
Right.
She doesn't want to take a position. And nobody ever wants to take a position, because then you can be held responsible. In our government, there's so little incentive for putting yourself on the hook and getting something done.
That's a great
point.
And
so I think all of these issues are really about process. We have to reform the political process.
John, you're a terrific caller. Do it again soon.
Yeah,
thank you so much. No,
thanks.
I mean it. You are dead on.
As
he is,
know,
totally right.
I'm for term limits.
Fine.
Jim is for... What's your line, Jim?
I don't know what it is. 877-301-8979.
Your line is only turned out. Election day.
You know, by the way, the problem with, I mean, John's right. It is the pogo-ass thing. We are the problem. But the flip side is, because members, I don't know where it all starts, members of Congress have done such an abysmal job, our expectations are so pitifully low that we don't even make demands anymore. I mean, it's almost their inaction on virtually everything has caused us to put less pressure on them rather than more pressure, because we know that nothing will come of their
meeting. But, you know, the people that are worried about the country going down the tubes and America going to hell in a handbasket and stuff like that, you know, we all remember the book we all had to read in college, the Alexis de Tocqueville thing, when was that written, 1820 or something like that, saying you have to have an engaged democracy. That's the only way it works. And we don't have an engaged democracy anymore. And some would argue that's the reason it doesn't work. Anyway, Carla from Sutton. Hi, Carla.
Hi, how are you?
Excellent, thank you.
Good. I take a little different view on this, and maybe I'm giving the American public an out. However, I feel that we elected a man to be president of this country. Our Congress has thwarted every effort that this man has tried to make. He has not been able to carry out the will of the American people, because our Congress has been able, through a minority, to stop every effort he's made. That has turned the American people off from being engaged. We elected someone, and yet he has been incapacitated right and left by the Congress.
But Charlotte, even if that's true, then based on that thesis, then Congress should never go back into session. The answer is, then let's call them for it. As John just said a couple of minutes ago from Somerville, let's work harder. If you think that they are doing nothing but negative things, let's work harder to make sure that they're not back there, as opposed to letting them just go home and enrich themselves with their campaign donations, right? I mean,
but I think it's a minority section of Congress that is able to do it.
Yeah.
And I think it's the Republicans trying always, even when it's a Republican idea that he's trying to go forward with, that they will vote against it. They have just been so counter to what the proposals were of this democratically elected president has tried to carry out.
Charlotte, I hear you. Just when we're talking about war, I think the rules of the game have to change. Charlotte, thank you so much
Charlotte's
for your call.
Charlotte's referring to the whole gerrymandering mess that's down there that enables a lot of very conservative Republicans to be elected over and over and over again. So we need some changes. But we're not going to change them now, because coming up, we're going to talk to the editor of the Boston Globe, Brian McGrory. Stay tuned for that conversation with him about this and some other things on 89.7 WGBH Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. I'm Jim Browdy. She's Marjorie Regan. He joins us every single Wednesday, although this is not Wednesday. He's joining us today. Anyway, he is the editor of the Boston Globe. That would be Brian McGrory. Hi, Brian.
Hello, Jim. How are you?
Great. Hey, Brian. Good to talk to you.
Hey, Marjorie. Great talking to you.
So we have been talking about this with our listeners. You know that we've all been watching the furious battle in Great Britain, the Parliament, over authorizing military action against ISIS. And meanwhile, we've seen our own Congress basically take a flyer to go home to campaign. You know, you covered Washington for a long time, and we know you're not a constitutional lawyer. But doesn't this strike you, to ask you a leading question, as a little odd?
Odd is one word for it. Disappointing is another word. I think I've done a few stints in Washington now, and what I learned initially and what was kind of the point that was pressed home again and again when I was down there is largely the work of Washington is about supporting Washington, which for the Congress means winning re-election. And you're catching the Congress right now in the throes of a re-election season. And the strikes in Syria and the Middle East are controversial. They would rather be home doing their country fairs and doing their town meetings and talking about Washington rather than being Washington talking about the issues.
You know, I'm so bent out of shape over this, I can't see straight. I don't want to weigh in, as Marjorie said, into whether they're constitutionally the president needs authorization or doesn't.
It's a whole different issue.
But the fact that they are not in Washington as we are beginning what everyone knows is a war that the president says is going to go on for years, either debating whether there should be an authorization, debating the airstrikes themselves, debating the strategy, is absolutely surreal to me.
Look, only part of the power of Capitol Hill is in the votes. A large piece of their authority simply comes from the bully pulpit. It's not only the White House that has access to that sort of pulpit. There are key senators and House committee chairmen who, if they pounded the podium and made their points clear, could have significant influence, especially if they did it en masse, if they had, you know, a large group of people who are pushing in one particular direction. But obviously this season they've chosen not to do that.
You know, again, Brian, you've been up close and personal covering D.C., as you say, many times over the years. Jim always has the same tired line. The only term limits we need are on Election Day. And he always brings out Ted Kennedy, the late great senator, and says, look at all the seniority he got and his expertise in Congress. And I get all that. But at the same time, I'm at the point now where I wonder if we're ever going to be able to get anything done in Congress that's good for the country and not good for reelection without term limits. Where are you on them?
Well, I think it's a more complicated issue, Marjorie. And by the way, that line of Jim's isn't just tired; it's utterly exhausted.
It is. It's just I hate to hear it.
I'm even tired of it, and I'm the one who says it. But go ahead, Brian.
But there are more complexities to that issue. We may, as Jim points out, may not need actual term limits, but what we do need is wholesale campaign reform, campaign finance reform, and right now, the entire system is driven towards allowing incumbents to win re-election. I mean, it was so aberrant that it was a national story when John Tierney lost in the 6th District here in Massachusetts in a primary. We need massive campaign finance reform. And, you know, little things as well as big things. It's incredible that this is something people rarely talk about, but when a congressman or senator runs for re-election, they do so while they are working a job that we are paying for. If a challenger challenges them, they are not even allowed to draw a salary from their campaign war chest, from whatever campaign funds they raise. They get criticized if they do it. we should begin at that most basic level, that if somebody is running against an incumbent, they can draw a salary in some form or fashion because we're already paying the incumbent to run for office. But it goes far beyond that as to where you raise money, how you raise money. I mean, we get into some, you know, some more incredibly complex issues.
By the way, who was it? Bob Dole, who, I mean, a variation of that theme is when people like Michael Dukakis, who I admire greatly, but was governor at the same time he's running for a year for the presidency. Was it Bob Dole who resigned his Senate seat to run for the presidency?
Yes, he did.
I think it was.
It was.
Now, some say
and
it was a strategic
lost,
consideration, but whether it was or not, I'm totally with you. And that's another tired theme of mine, by the way. Hey, speaking
there
of tired
so many, Jim.
Questions, Brian McGorry, is Deval Patrick going to be the next Attorney General of the United States?
It's a really good question, and it's one obviously everybody was asking yesterday. My gut is no, but please don't play that tape back the day he gets nominated. All indications right now, he's telling people, as the Globe reported today, he's telling people privately, as most senior aides, that it's not going to happen for him this time.
Well, you know, I'm sure you're watching your favorite television show last night. That would be Broadside, the News with Jim Browdy. When John Walsh said to me, the campaign manager for Deval Patrick for governor, obviously the chair of the Democratic State Committee, and then he left to run Together PAC, which virtually all of us assume was the PAC that was going to allow Deval Patrick to be funded to run for president someday, whether it's 2016, 2020. Walsh told me last night, which I did not know, and I asked it facetiously, so I assume, John, you're shutting down Together PAC immediately after Deval steps down as governor. And the answer is yes. Does that, I mean, to me, what conclusion should one draw from that, Brian McGorry?
It's interesting. When I saw Broadside Live last night, I didn't catch that reference. But the second time I watched it online this morning, as I always do with your shows.
Yeah, me too, actually.
That one really jumped out at me.
Okay, well, thanks.
I am surprised he's shutting down that PAC. I'm very surprised. My impression of what Deval Patrick wanted to do was step out of public office, get a lucrative career in the private sector ginned up again, perhaps with a full-time job, perhaps sitting on multiple boards, make some more money, and someday think about whether he wanted to step back into public life, whether that's viable or not.
You know, Brian, one of the great things about watching a Broadside of the News with Jim Browdy the next morning live is, I mean, online, is that you can avoid all those wonderful ads you have on your show, Jim, for all those cat scratching toys.
Okay, fine.
I've fallen and I can't get up whistles.
They're important to some people. I wouldn't be laughing at them, Brian. That'll be you someday.
That's right. We'll
hey,
all be
Brian,
there soon.
Let me tell you why my prediction is that he does do this. That's enough on that topic.
They're great ads.
They pay the bills. Is, you know, I read a lot about Holder because I have mixed feelings about him. You know, on one hand, I thought he was courageous. And remember the Nation of Cowards line in an early speech, because we don't talk about race. I thought he was great in Ferguson while he talked about his own experiences driving while black. On the flip side, nobody from Wall Street ever prosecuted. Signing off on the NSA's monitoring of innocent Americans' phone calls and emails and that sort of thing. But, you know, the one thing that struck me in almost everything I read about him is that the president trusts him because they're very close personally. And this is a president who is a lonely president who, with the exception of Michelle Obama and Valerie Jarrett, who he brought with him from Chicago, essentially trusts no one and talks to no one. And one of the few exceptions to that rule was Eric Holder. While Deval Patrick is not nearly as close to Obama as is Holder, they do seem to have a burgeoning personal relationship. And it seems to me that matters a lot when you're finishing out your second term, you're worried about your legacy, and you have nobody to talk to. Don't you think that's a relevant consideration, even if Patrick doesn't intend to do it, about whether or not Obama will ask him to do it?
Yeah, maybe not. I mean, does that kind of close personal relationship, if in fact it is a close personal relationship, matter more at the end of a term, or does it matter more than you're ramping up a term or in the middle of a term? I honestly don't know the answer to that. And when you scrape everything away, and I'm not saying it's not true, we don't know the extent of the relationship between Patrick and Obama. We know they have dinner on occasion. We know that they have run eerily similar campaigns for office, but I don't know what it's like in a room between the two, so I don't think I'd be qualified to address that.
By the way, I don't know either, but it isn't stopping me. So
I
should,
was just going to point that out.
Thank you very much. We're talking to Brian McGrory. He is the editor of the Boston Globe.
You know, Brian McGrory, your reporter Maria Cicchetti wrote a great piece about our government deporting kids of parents, or at least teenagers of parents, who were allowed to stay, focusing on this one family where the parents got to come over here. They got allowed work permits after the earthquakes in El Salvador in 2001, and their teenage kid came over here fleeing gang violence 2 years ago, and he's going to be deported unless something changes. And not only is he going to be deported, but this piece says that there are thousands of people in this same position, and that Immigration and Customs Enforcement won't talk about this case, citing privacy concerns. I was in a rage reading this piece. What do you make of it?
Isn't it extraordinary? First of all, Maria Cicchetti is a fantastic immigration reporter, for my money, one of the best in the country. She has written many, many signature stories about immigration issues for the Globe, a lot of which absolutely drive the federal government crazy.
Good.
And this was another particularly good one. The situation with people who have come here from El Salvador and Honduras and given temporary protected status. Which is great that the government has done that. It's a noble thing for the government to do. But it is, as you point out, virtually impossible to get your mind around that when their children make it here, often through great danger, to be reunited with their parents, that we take the utterly absurd step of actually deporting them back into a dangerous land. It's great that Maria was able to point this out.
Well, it's doubly great because the problem with our endless discussions here and elsewhere about the immigration debate, it's always about the politics. The do-nothing Congress, they don't care. All they want to do is obstruct Obama. Is Obama going too far? She puts a human face on this, and I defy even Tancredo, whatever his name was, the former congressman who was the most anti any kind of immigration reform. I defy that kind of person to read this story and say this system is not grotesquely broken.
It's one of the most basic elements of human nature. Parents want to be with their children. Children need to be with their parents. And to have the government get in the way of that is, like I said earlier, it's virtually impossible to get your head around.
And I don't get this from Obama either. I mean, I just don't understand why he's allowing his immigration people to continue in this route. I mean, he's in his second term now. Can he make a unilateral decision about this?
Well, that's the interesting question about whether or not, I wasn't clear, do they need Congress to change something, or can he just by executive fiat, as Marjorie's suggesting, have ICE decide that in these circumstances, they're saying as many as 20,000 kids in these circumstances, the kid stays reunited with a parent's, end of discussion. Let John Boehner sue him.
I was going to say, look, I'm not an expert on it. I don't know the need to change the law, but I mean, give me a break. The government can just simply stop enforcing that small aspect of the law.
We're talking to Brian McGrory from the Boston Globe. Brian, the Globe and WGBH are sponsoring one of the debates in the gubernatorial election. Ours will be the first one-on-one debate. And I have to say, the email, since it was in the Globe a couple of days ago, Jim O'Sullivan wrote a piece about it, I would say it's fairly split. Some people saying, how dare you decide, you, the Globe and GBH, decide that the three independents who are qualified for the ballot not participate in your debate when they aren't others. And others are saying, thank God, we're going to hear from one of the two, only the two people, one of whom will be the next governor of the Commonwealth. How did you come down ultimately on the side that GBH did, that it was time mid-debate season to have a one-on-one?
Look, I think the public is your side also believes the public deserves the right to hear from the two major candidates, and they have the right to hear from them without the interference, the static, if you will, from the third-party candidates who have yet to gain traction in any poll. If we saw any indication that any of them were emerging is a viable alternative, we would include them in. But to this point in time, we just haven't seen evidence of that. And you have every legal right to be on the ballot if you are a third-party candidate, but you do not have a legal right to be on a stage when we're holding a debate. It's simply not the case. And at this point in time, we thought that the voters were better served by putting the two major candidates up. And our job is to serve the voters as best we can, not the candidates who are running for office.
Yeah, Brian, you guys, that is the Boston Globe.
By the way, we did this, sorry to cut you off, Marjorie.
Okay.
We did this when Martha Coakley ran against Scott Brown. We held the line. Martha Coakley was insisting that third-party candidates be involved in the debate. We held the line, and my recollection is that there didn't end up to be any sort of one-on-one debate that year, and that was too bad.
Brian, you guys, as in the Boston Globe, had a poll today showing Charlie Baker slightly ahead of Martha Coakley. It was taken before this sweetheart remark he made the other day to Carmen, I was mispronounced her last name.
Charmin Sacchetti.
Fox
25.
From Fox 25 News. A terrific reporter, by the way.
She's really great.
Yeah, she is. Her,
you know, she's Maria Sacchetti's sister.
No.
I did not know that.
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
That's pretty great, actually. I didn't know that. I thought
God.
It was just the coincidence.
Maria Sacchetti is the reporter who did the fantastic immigration story we were talking about a moment ago.
How weird is that? Two women from the same family could both going into journalism in different milieus. Well, anyway, it was taken before Charlie made his sweetheart remark, last question, sweetheart, I'm paraphrasing, to Charmin Sacchetti, which became a big deal. You know, NARAL and other women's groups were complaining about this. Do you think it's going to hurt Charlie Baker? The rap, of course, on Charlie Baker is he's had difficulty getting women in his camp.
You know, I don't know that yet. I don't know. It's certainly not playing favorably for him. Let's establish that. Whether it hurts him or not, I don't know. What I do know is that he's got to be a little bit more careful in the public eye with remarks like that, because they can prove to be revealing if this continues as a pattern. And I'm not saying there is a pattern yet, but he's got to do a gut check on this and whether a remark like this reveals more about him than maybe he'd want us to know.
You know, my immediate reaction to this, Brian, you may not be surprised, was we already have term limits. They're called elections. I don't know. Okay.
Well, a serious question, Jim.
Yeah.
Would you over there
yes.
use the term sweetheart if you're talking in a public setting to one of your colleagues?
No. Well, actually,
hold on.
Apparently he missed
hold
my show
on.
The other
if
night.
If you had been watching Broadside the News with Jim Browdy, this is a great moment. You should even look this one up. This is so great. Jim is a Republican woman. What's her name?
Keiko Orrell. She represents Lakeville. She's
okay.
a state rep.
She's a state rep. She's on his show. And apparently before the show begins, he says...
This is the night that this thing breaks.
That's right.
Want me to tell
you're
the story?
Gonna
you're
gonna tell? No, I'm going to tell the story.
Go ahead.
Before the show begins, he tells Keiko that she can sit where she's going to sit. He says, this is your seat, sweetheart.
And then he says, I meant it as a joke, obviously.
I'm only kidding. They get on the air. He asks her about Charlie Baker saying sweetheart. She turns to him and says, you just called me sweetheart before the show began. And Jim says, well, I was only kidding. And then she says, well, Charlie Baker was only kidding. And Jim says in a huff, well, I'm not running for governor. She nailed him hook, line, and sinker.
Marjorie's told the story every day this week. But, you know, the answer is no, I would not. At least I would not. Marjorie, let's move this.
You hear what he calls me,
Brian. But can I tell you, the discussion we had yesterday, and I'm not passing judgment on Charlie Baker on this, let the voters do this. The discussion we had at length yesterday, which drives me out of my mind, not the discussion, is the double standard. Is we were talking about women's groups. You know, Charlie Baker is now a heathen as a result of this. But when Barack Obama in 2008, before he was elected, in a Detroit auto plant called a local reporter, Sweetie, were these same groups up in arms? Were they saying he's unfit? He has this great bias against women? I mean, there really is the ultimate double standard on this kind of thing. I've gotten it out of my system. Okay.
Is you going to let Brian respond to you?
Yeah, go ahead, Brian.
There's nothing to respond to when you're going back and forth
yeah.
like that.
There sorry.
I completely agree. The double standard is, incredibly evident. And, again, on Charlie Baker, this is similar in some respects and dissimilar in other respects to Warren Tolman using the unbecoming remark on Mitt in this past campaign for Attorney General, and Mitt Romney using the word unbecoming against Shannon O'Brien in, was it 2002? There was something, and I can't quite put my finger on it, there was something a little bit different about Charlie Baker using the word sweetheart than those two using the word unbecoming. Sweetheart is much more direct. Unbecoming, you may use that inadvertently. Sweetheart, you don't. Sweetheart is, for my money, to be quite honest, and again, I'm not passing judgment on Charlie Baker, but it is more condescending than the word unbecoming.
Well, but in fairness, to end this discussion to Charlie, which may not change anything, is a nanosecond after he said it, he puts his hand out, maybe on her shoulder, I don't know what it was, and says, I'm kidding.
Well, that's good. Puts his hand on her shoulder.
Okay, fine. Now, one last... Okay, forget.
At least he didn't put his hand on her butt, Jim.
Okay, fine. Thank you, Marjorie, for that.
Did you put your hand on the woman that was on your shoulder?
No, I did not. And by the way, it was a joke, and if I were her, I wouldn't have mentioned it on the air. It was an off-the-air
And Jib was
comment.
Really ticked off that she did.
Off.
It was great.
She won't be back on.
Guys, if it's
soon.
At all helpful, I can hang up and
no,
just go at it like
last. No, you can't hang up quite yet because Marjorie and I were having this discussion, and I'm sure I am right. We were discussing where your seats are for Sunday's final game of Derek Jeter at Fenway. So tell us where they are, and then we'll tell you who was right.
There is no right way to answer this question.
No, just tell us where you're sitting. It's no big deal. Where are you sitting?
I will be sitting on my couch at home.
You are so full of it.
With an HDTV watching the game. Who do I know that's involved with the Red Sox? How would I get over there?
Exactly.
Brian, raise your right hand and tell us you are not going to Derek Jeter's final game in his career.
Well, here's the deal, Jim. As of this moment, I wasn't because I didn't have tickets, but you may have helped my cause.
Okay,
with
fine.
So,
okay. Brian waved to us. We'll be watching on our couches the final game. Are you going to, by the way, we're going to ask Dan Shaughnessy, yeah. We're going to talk to him in a few minutes. And one of our questions for him is we hope Red Sox fans are going to cheer this guy at the end of his 20-year legendary, clean, no PED career. Fans are going to cheer him, aren't they?
If he doesn't get a standing ovation that goes on for at least 1 to 2 minutes, I will be utterly shocked. Say this about Boston fans, and I know that they're controversial at times. Boston fans, especially Red Sox fans, and actually I think the same applies for Celtics fans, appreciate the sport as much as they appreciate the team. There is utterly no question in my mind. I'll be stunned if Shaughnessy disagrees. There's no question in my mind. Jeter will get a reception at Fenway that will. He'll remember for a lifetime.
I hope so.
Oh, good. I hope so.
Do you remember when the Philadelphia 76ers beat us in the conference finals back in, 1970-something, and the entire garden stood up and chanted, beat L.A., beat L.A.
Oh, yes, actually,
for many minutes, even though we were just vanquished by what was our big conference rival.
Yeah, good point. Hey, Brian, if you get an extra ticket, you know my cell number, okay?
You keep looking. Make sure that phone is charged up all weekend, because you know it can come at any
fine.
Time.
Thank you.
Thank you very much,
good
Brian.
Good to talk to you, Brian McGrory. Kicking off hour two of BPR, in Hollywood fashion, Derek Jeter hits the game winner in his final at bat at Yankee Stadium last night. Dan Shaughnessy reviews a legendary career. Then we'll ask you if you'll cheer number two in pinstripes this weekend. Then Callie Crossy reviews 6 years of Eric Holder and sets the odds on Deval Patrick succeeding him. Then she'll weigh in on the very controversial New York Times portrayal of Shonda Rhimes as the angry black woman. Then Celtic Sojourn's Brian O'Donovan takes us on a tour of the best local live shows you never heard of, but shouldn't miss.
Emily Rooney joins us with her famous list of gripes and complaints. This week, she even complains about her intro music. Then our Friday news quiz featuring a husband and wife team of gypsy brewers, and they're brewing the hottest new beer brand around. All that coming up on Boston Public Radio, 89.7 WGBH. I am Marjorie Egan. You're listening to Hour 2 of our new 3-hour edition of Boston Public Radio on 89.7 WGBH. Hello, Jim.
We almost made it through a whole week of 3 hours. Not quite yet. So in case you're watching C-SPAN staring at the empty congressional chambers, you probably missed how Derek Jeter wrote the perfect ending to his illustrious Yankee Stadium career last night.
Meek deals. Base hit to right field. Here comes Richardson. Here's the throw from Markakis. Richardson is safe. Derek Jeter ends his final game with a walk-off single. Derek Jeter, where fantasy becomes reality. Did you have any doubt?
Did you have any doubt this weekend Jeter will be at Fenway Park, as you know, to end his career? Joining us on the line to take stock of Derek Jeter is Dan Shaughnessy. Dan's a sports columnist for the Boston Globe and co-author of Francona, the Red Sox Years. Hey, Dan.
How are you guys?
We're
hey,
great.
Great, Dan Shaughnessy. Well, I'm probably one of those much-hated pink hat fans. You know, I don't really know that much about baseball. But even I watched your video this morning. You look at this guy, you know, no steroids, no strippers, no sexual harassment, no, you know, beating up any girlfriends like everybody else seems to be in sports. I mean, he was really, or I shouldn't say was, he's still around, but unusual in that, not to mention his talent.
Yeah, it's hard to be 20 years in New York with his kind of fame and money and profile and being a single guy and just nothing ever touched him. It was really remarkable. Reminded me a little bit of, you know, in the sense with Caroline and John Kennedy Jr., these kids raised with so much around them and very little nonsense ever attaching them. I was told that, like, if you went to Jeter's apartment for a party or something, you had to turn in your cell phone when you got there, just being very careful and obviously a great teammate and a great performer. And it's nice to see a guy with one team his whole career.
Yeah. So what was the deal? Was it great mom and dad or great mentoring, or do you know what was going on with him personally?
Well, yeah, the strong parental unit, Kalamazoo, Michigan, and, you know, all the values that you like, and his parents are at a lot of games, and he, right from the jump, was all about team and winning. And baseball is a very selfish sport, and most guys, if they get three hits and the team loses, they're pretty happy with the day, and other guys go the other way. And I think with Jeter, it really was about whether they won the game or not at the end of the day, and that's hard to find. And Yankees had it for 20 years there, and it made him the ideal captain, and a leader of men and setting by example. He never gave us much. You know, he was always very guarded and almost boring to a point, which was by design. That was all part of the MO.
Dan, I saw on your video on BostonGlobe.com, you said one of the five greatest Yankees ever after Mantle, Gehrig, Ruth, and DiMaggio. Is that a controversial position in your trade, or is that the conventional wisdom amongst those who do what you do?
It's easy for me. I've seen him elevated in some of those things, and they have a very lofty pantheon. So you can get into Yogi Berra, Whitey Ford, Mariano Rivera, certainly, and some people would put Jeter, you know, higher than that. I just those four that you cited, that to me remains their kind of Rushmore, and then Jeter's a worthy fifth guy for that. But it's nice to have those kind of choices, because not many organizations have those kind of iconic figures.
You know, most of us are all in, whether we grew up in Philly and are Philly fans, then are transplants, or people like you and Marjorie are locals. But as a sports columnist and somebody who does keep an arm's length relationship, which I think is one of your best traits, when you're watching this thing last night and he hits this walk-off, what was your reaction? What was your reaction, Dan Shaughnessy?
Well, I mean, it was all teed up, and it was a nice moment, and the way that the Orioles tied the game in the top of the inning and forcing them to come back to bat, and there he is, delivers the hit, a very, very typical Jeter hit, the inside-out swing to right field, and the nice celebration. I was just initially concerned that he might not play here, and that there was going to be some sort of announcement. I talked to Derek about 3 weeks ago in New York, and I got him alone, and I said, listen, you know, what's the deal for these last three in Boston, and are you going to play there? And he said, well, why wouldn't I? And I'm like, okay, well, I'll take that as a yes. And he said, well, don't read too much into anything. I don't do hypotheticals. I'm thinking, well, how hard is it to just say you're going to play in Boston? And he wasn't giving me that, and I explained to him the lineage of Ted Williams. I said, you know what Ted did? And he says, well, yeah, he hit a home run his last time up. I said, well, do you know that they had three games in New York after he hit that home run? He didn't go. And he did not know that. He talked a little bit about Mariano Rivera, who finished in New York last year and then made the trip to Houston but did not pitch. And he just left it open just enough where he would not have been caught in a lie if he decided not to either come to Boston or not to play in Boston. And so what he gave us, from what I gather, is he's going to DH here. He may not even play tonight, but he's not going to be out of shortstop. He decided that that's the end. You know, that the Yankees are eliminated, so the games don't mean anything. That's rare for them. And but he, as a service to the Boston fans, he wants to to appear here. And obviously people who have paid thousands of dollars for tickets on Sunday, many of them New Yorkers coming up for this, want to see his last at bat. And apparently you are going to see that at Fenway. I just don't think you're going to see him at shortstop.
By the way, that video, I was in tears watching that video this morning. I loved it so much. How hard was it to get him alone? Was that difficult?
He's always been very good to me. It's unusual. I think it's probably because he doesn't know me.
Yeah.
You know, it's,
that's right. Who's this guy with the red curls coming at me?
but he's an observant guy, and he knows you're around all the time. So he would recognize me as a Boston guy. And, you know, he has a lot of regard for the rivalry, and we're just around them so much. And I've always tried to work the other room a lot, because you learn a lot about your own team working the other room. And I always found him to be approachable and polite. Doesn't give you a lot, but he's very polite about it. So those guys, the professional guys, it's always helpful. And, of course, he's such a high-profile guy. It was good because, you know, I would ask him what it's like when he'd go to lunch here at Davio's and whatever. I mean, because there was a lot of nonsense with, you know, Jeter this, Jeter that, T-shirts, yeah, some vile stuff. And I'm thinking, that must be weird to be walking around with that. And he really would say, you know, I don't get that. People are very nice to me on the streets, and I know fans are fans and what they're saying, but when I'm, my encounters on the streets of Boston are very good. He would always say that.
I want to ask you my final thing about the fans of Boston, but you know, the classiness of him playing here and saying, as he did last night, the that he owes it to the Boston fans, et cetera, particularly after the storybook moment. I mean, what a way to end it, which causes me to admire more. So the final thing is, forget the Yankee fans at Fenway on Sunday, Dan. How are Red Sox fans going to treat this guy?
Oh, this will be a coronation for the enemy. He'll get great treatment here. People are, you know, there's nothing to play for here. Everybody's there for him at this point. That's why you're at the game. And the whole ship sailed about, you know, the rivalry or the hated opponent. Mm-hmm. So this is a worthy adversary. It will be as if Larry Bird's here, as far as I'm concerned. This will be, you know, he'll be celebrated like one of your own at the end, I think, because people just have a lot of regard for his body of work and his standing as a worthy rival.
Oh, I'm so glad you said that, because I was afraid that you were going to say something else, which would make me feel very unhappy for my fellow Bostonians. But that's great to hear.
Good to talk to you, Dan.
Thank you very much for taking the time to be with us. I really appreciate it. And great video today. Great stuff, as always. I mean, Dan Shaughnessy is unbelievable calmness. Thank you, Dan. Dan Shaughnessy is a great, great sports columnist for the Boston Globe and co-author of Frank Kona, The Red Sox Years.
Now we're going to open the phone lines and ask you, is Derek Jeter a once-in-a-lifetime kind of player? Is Red Sox Nation, just as we asked Dan, big enough this weekend to give the acclaimed Yankee his due? And what I'm most interested in, actually, is why does Jeter have so much appeal to non-sports fans like Marjorie Egan? 877-301-8970. And he does, by the way. He is one of these the athletes who transcends his sport. And for you, what is it? Because your son is a huge Yankee fan, or what is it?
That's part of it. And he was at the next to last game, and he was pretty
in New York City.
In New York City. Well, he lives in New York City.
Would you lend him $1,000 or something? How'd he get
that? No, the Yankees tickets are much cheaper than the Red Sox tickets.
Oh, I thought they were up for the final couple of games.
Oh, they certainly are for the last game. I think he told me the cheapest tickets were like $350.
Average was $600.
Okay, average was $600. So we didn't go to that. We went to the next to last game. But when you think of all the big sports stars, there are exceptions, you know, who seem to have enormous talent, enormous drive, enormous class, and a certain, you know, he's got a great dignity about him. I mean, a lot of these other sports guys, they're always in trouble. I mean, you think of the Larry Bird, who was a massive hero here in Boston, the Celtics. Then you found out he had this kid that he
treated like crap, his daughter.
So that was very upsetting. I mean, Tom Brady seems to have the perfect life, but he does, I guess. But it's different than Jeter because it's so much flashier than Jeter's. Jeter wasn't a flashy guy. You'd see him around town, but it wasn't always at some gala with, you know, in his black tie and that kind of stuff. So he's unusual, at least to me. Our number is 877-301-8970, 877-301-8970, especially at the Yankees. You know, when Dan Shaughnessy went down that whole list of Yankees that were great. I mean, a lot of them were very troubled people. He seems not to be a troubled guy.
You mean like
guy.
Babe Ruth, for example?
Well, Babe Ruth
had a drinking issue.
Drinking
and
problem
a woman
and a
issue.
Womanizing thing. And Joe DiMaggio was married to Marilyn Monroe, but that
was
kind of weird.
Sin or something?
No, but it was sort of a weird relationship. I mean, come on. He was married to Marilyn Monroe. And plus, he never talked to anybody. You know, he was kind of very – remember the great Frank Sinatra story? I mean, the great Gay Talese story about trying to get an interview with
– No.
With Joe DiMaggio. Yeah, no. I was chasing all over the place trying to get an interview with Gay Talese. He's a great writer about New York. Anyway, our number is 877-301-8970, 877-301-8970. I saw the Dan Shaughnessy video this morning, and I was practically in tears.
Can I tell you something? Let me give you my thesis on this. So we have Dan Shaughnessy saying he's going to be cheered. We have Brian McGorry, big, long-time, lifetime local, saying he's going to be cheered. Here's my thesis.
What?
If the Red Sox had not won in 2004, come down from three games behind, and reversed the proverbial curse, to quote a Shaughnessy title, my sense is there's no chance that they'd be cheering this guy. We're not big enough. We're big enough now because we conquered, the Red Sox nation has conquered the Yankee curse. 877-301-8970. Don't bother calling and saying it wasn't the curse. I know it wasn't the curse, but I'm telling you, just using the verbiage of the day. 877-301-8970. And by the way, to his credit, let me just say what I said, I think, Dan, at the end. If I were him.
Who?
And if I were Derek Jeter.
Oh.
And I had a moment like last night, like he had. I mean, does it end any better? The only thing he could have done better is hit a home run rather than a single to win the game.
Right.
That's your final moment. The
but
fact that he said,
something.
You hear his quotes last night? Exactly. He says, I owe it to the Red Sox fans.
Yeah,
it's a
to
right
go thing. There.
That's actually
and
quite great.
And he also in the video had this great moment comparing Nomar Garciaparra, who was the great hitter of the Red Sox, with Derek Jeter. And I am not a sports big
we know.
Sports
okay,
person.
Fine.
But he talked about Derek Jeter at this particular game jumping into the stands to retrieve
a ball.
And he got a bloody nose or you know black eye. And Nomar Garciaparra was on the bench sulking, apparently, because he couldn't play that night.
Well, excuse me. There's another issue with Nomar Garciaparra. The cover of Sports Illustrated, where he looks like a bodybuilder. And most people are convinced that as PED-free as we believe Jeter to have been, that was the opposite with Garciaparra. In any case, 877-301-8970. Is Red Sox Nation big enough to cheer this guy this weekend? And why the appeal to non-big-time sports fans like Marjorie Egan right here?
Let's start with Dan in Providence. Hi, Dan. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Dan.
Oh, you might be talking to me. My name's Ben.
Oh, I'm
Ben.
Sorry. I'm sorry.
Can
Ben's
we talk to
Providence.
Dan instead, Ben? I'm kidding. Hi, Ben.
No, that's okay. That's no big deal.
Sure.
To your point, I'm actually not a huge baseball fan, but I have a cousin, her name's Katie, who is a huge baseball fan, a huge Red Sox fan, in fact. Mm-hmm. And she ran into Derek Jeter somewhere at some point, you know, out in public. And it just really struck me that she said that he just kind of looked like, you know, a normal guy and a normal sized guy. You know, he didn't look all juiced up or anything. And I think that's kind of one of the reasons that people that aren't even huge baseball fans like myself. I'm more of a hockey guy. It's really cool to see someone who at least on all fronts doesn't appear, you know, to be you know, using steroids or trying.
Did your cousin talk to Jeter or just see him?
You know, she said she talked to him just for a moment, just in passing. She didn't want to, you know, do the whole celebrity thing.
Sure.
And, hey, you know, it's amazing to see you. Let me get your autograph. She just kind of said hi, and he said hi back to her.
I like it.
Well, you know, that
Ben,
puts,
thanks for the call.
That's another great thing. I mean, I always felt, not that I'm condoning it, but I felt kind of bad for some of these baseball players, because when everybody around you with the team is using steroids and you are some 20-year-old coming, you know, in from Oklahoma, wherever you came from.
You don't have a chance.
And you say to yourself, I'm not going to succeed if I don't do steroids.
Right.
Now, this is a guy who apparently, and I hope we don't get found wrong, but this is a guy who apparently succeeded. So think about how great his talent was that he could manage to do that, surrounded by all these juiced up
wonderful
players.
Wonderful point. Heidi,
thank
you're in
you,
New
Jim.
Hampshire.
I thought it was a wonderful point myself.
Heidi, you're next on Boston Public Radio. Thank you very much for the call, Heidi. Hi.
Hi, how are you?
We're great. Thank you.
Good. I just wanted to say that I'm the mother of six children, and two of my boys play baseball.
Mm-hmm.
But Derek Jeter has something that I can teach all my children: his grace under pressure, his grace respect of the game, his work ethic. So even though, you know, he does have that allure to the baseball fans, my children can respect him for other reasons as well.
That's beautiful, Heidi.
That's a great point. And it's somewhat unusual. I mean, I'm sure there are a lot of other great guys. I just don't know about them.
Well, you know, also, keep in mind, Heidi, that this retirement, not that it wasn't a big deal a month ago, this retirement comes on the heels of Ray Rice and Adrian Peterson. And so the juxtaposition of a Jeter-like human as compared to one guy who's beating his wife and the other guy who is beating his kid, I mean, makes him even more exalted. That's a great call, Heidi. Thank you so much. Mother of six.
Mother of six.
In New Hampshire.
Good for you, Heidi. That's a lot of work. Peter from Holden. Thank you for calling, Peter.
Hello, Peter.
Hey, good afternoon, you two. Thank you for the call and
pleasure.
Thanks for the topic.
Thanks.
I can set the table a little bit for who I am. I'm a 50-year-old Red Sox fan and, you know, woke my whole house up when Carlton Fisk hit the home run and was in the park right after September 11th, the Yankees' first game with my entire family. And on one side of the sign, we had, "We love New York." And on the other side of the sign, we said, "But the Yankees still," and you know what I wrote. And the Yankees came over to take photos with it, and we stood... We searched for 5 minutes to tell New Yorkers that you're still Americans, we still care about you. Mm. And then you jump to Derek. You know, as Red Sox fans, we're really taught, especially in my generation, the love of the game. And not just to play it, but how you play it. And the love of Derek as a baseball player is because of the effort he brings, the respect, like the last caller, she was wonderful, and talking about how he brings so much to the game, but he's a baseball player. And if you truly love baseball, then the umpire should have to tell you to sit down on Sunday, because that's what you're cheering. Get rid of the uniforms, get rid of all that. What are you cheering? You're cheering one of the greatest baseball players who ever lived. And frankly, another point is, and I'm happy about it, because for the first hero that the Yankees have ever had, he had 5 World Series. And this time, we had 3. DiMaggio had them all. Babe had them all. Mantle had them all. We always had 0 against all those other icons. Well, with Derek, guess what? It's 5-3. We finally stood up against the Yankees, against a graceful man, and I'll be showing that respect on Sunday.
Peter, that was beautiful, too. Hey, thanks for the call. That was great.
Mickey Mantle's another guy. He had all the liquor and the womanizing problems as well.
Yes, he did. Well, you know, one of the great books. You ever read Red Bull for Jim Boughton? The first book written by a former baseball player. Jim Boughton was a pitcher for the Yankees, and he wrote a book that really started a genre of sports literature. And by the way, it may be a bit dated, but it is totally great. It gave you an inside look. Now we know everything, obviously, because of 24/7 cable and the internet. We didn't know anything then about what our heroes were doing. It is brilliant, and it is wildly
funny. Who did the great movie about Roger Maris and Mickey Mantle?
Oh, well, Billy Crystal did
yeah,
it.
Yeah, Billy Crystal.
I think it's called 61, Maris had 61 home runs.
It was terrific about, you know, the fans rooting for Mickey Mantle and being upset when Roger Maris would be catching up to him and stuff like that. And Roger Maris is another guy, a man of few words,
yes,
as
was.
It were.
877-301-8970 is our phone number.
Leah in New Hampshire. What do you think about Derek Jeter, Leah?
Hi, Leah.
Hi, guys. Thank you so much for taking my call.
Sure.
I actually want to echo previous sentiments that Heidi from New Hampshire said, too. I think growing up in New England, you have this idea of what a work ethic is supposed to be. It's sort of this idea about, you know, keeping your head down, putting your nose to the grindstone, kind of avoiding all of the sort of glitzy, glam, trouble kind of stuff. And I think Jeter really, really embodies that. I respect him tremendously as a Red Sox fan. And I really hope that everybody gives him a super warm reception on Sunday at Fenway. So.
How grown up everybody is, I'll tell you.
I know. It's
Leah,
very heartwarming.
If you're a Red Sox fan, do you think you'd feel the same way 10 years ago before they had won their first World Series in 80-some years? You'd feel the same way?
I hope so.
I hope so, too.
I don't know.
You're an honest woman. Leah, thank you very much for your call.
There seems to be a consensus brewing here. Well, we got Bob from Arlington. I think he's on Facebook saying, thinks no true baseball fan should boo Derek Jeter.
Well, also, let me say, it really is, I think it's, again, take nothing away from a 20-year brilliant career. He never was MVP, but he was, you know, steady, really good, 3,400 hits or something. I mean, he's an incredible baseball player. He so stands out because of the era that we're in, both from drugs and violence, which makes his stature even greater.
Who's the other guy that played a million games? Ripken? What was his name?
Cal Ripken.
Cal Ripken. He was another one of those kind of guys. Yeah. You just, you know, saw the things about him, and it made you weepy just to hear about him.
You know,
him.
For a person who says she's not a sports fan, you're really pulling him out there, Marjorie.
Well, you know.
Who do you play for?
I have no idea.
Okay, it's fine. Doesn't really matter. Does it? I just know he played. Oh, it's Barbara Mikulski's favorite team.
He played more consecutive games than anybody else. Right. Wasn't that his claim to fame?
Baltimore Orioles.
Baltimore Orioles. Thank
Let's
you
go to
much,
Richard. Jim. You're in Providence, Rhode Island, one of our favorite cities. Hey there, Richard.
Hi, Jim. Hi, Marjorie. Thanks for taking my call.
Thanks sure. for calling.
Hey, Jim, you know, I rarely agree with you, and today it's no exception.
Why, Richard? What's up?
I'm going to tell you that I think Boston is such a sports town, and the rivalry with Boston and New York is so important that regardless of us winning the World Series three times, one time, we would herald Jeter or any great baseball player, whether it was from any town, but especially New York, like Jeter, and especially Jeter because he played such an important role in this rivalry. Just because we're a sports town, we love sports so much that a person who's played the game with such, and here's the word, that a great player like Jeter with such humility.
Yeah, I agree.
That's a great word.
Well, you know, let me say one thing else. The other proof of your, well, I don't know if it proves your point about we needed the World Series or not, but another Yankee, didn't we give a tremendous a farewell ovation to Mariano Rivera, who was arguably the greatest closer in the history of baseball, who obviously ended his career last year. So, Richard, you may get to my position or I may get to yours. Richard, thank you. Thank you much for the call. You know, it's pretty exciting. I have to say, I wasn't awake for this last night because I go to bed fairly early.
That's right. But started the crack of dawn.
Well, I woke up this morning and saw the Derek Jeter thing. If you haven't seen it, even if you're not a baseball fan, they know it's last
great.
At bat. The Yankees are down to the Baltimore Orioles. I think five to two or something. The Yankees come back and tie it. And then in the bottom of the ninth inning, the last inning, unless it went to extra innings, probably the last bat in this 20-year career in Yankee Stadium, and we had no idea if he was going to play in Boston.
Oh, I hope he.
The guy hits the winning single. I mean,
I hope he doesn't like strike out here. That would be terrible.
Well, you know what happened? By the way, you know, in the All-Star game, you know, it was a big controversy. You probably don't know
this. I don't know this.
That a pitcher, I think for the St. Louis Cardinals,
gave him a soft
grooved
pitch.
A pitch.
Yes, I do know
and
this.
And then said, I grooved it for him.
Yeah.
And he's meatball or something. And then he said, because there was so much criticism, he says, no, I didn't do that. But don't you believe in the final? The Red Sox are out of it. The Yankees are out of it. He has his last as bad. His parents are going to be there on Sunday. You just throw him. I mean, you throw it right down.
Edward just emailed and said Jeter was never once ejected from a game.
I don't know if that's correct,
but if that's true, Edward, thank you for that.
In any case, we're done with Jeter, at least until Monday. But before we go, we wanted to preview this. Boston Globe Shira Springer, one of our favorites, is on the line. Shira is going to be joining us on Monday to talk about her reporting in this Sunday's Globe magazine. And the reason we want to talk to her about it today briefly to preview it is because this is a topic she and we have discussed both on air and off air. So joining us briefly is Shira Springer, investigative enterprise reporter for the sports section of the Boston Globe. Hey there, Shira.
Hey, how you doing?
Great. So what are you doing? We've been waiting.
Well, I did a story on basically why do fans ignore women's pro sports and what can be done to make fans care more about them. And it basically boils down to, you know, they need to make the game experience better. They need to get more exposure for women's teams. And then there are the economics issues. They need more sponsors. They need more financial support. So it's a whole bunch of factors as to why it is that women pro sports cannot get the support that they need.
You know, every time I talk about this with Shira, I feel like I should lose my card, my membership in the sisterhood, because I must admit,
Did you go to a BC women's college game where Scott Brown's kid played?
I did, and she was a great basketball player, but it's not Ayla the Brown. Same. It's not the same as watching men. I hate to say that.
Yeah, and I think part of that is true, and part of that, though, is perception and a failure in marketing on the part of women's pro sports.
Well, Shira, we're going to be reading this thing, and we are thrilled that you're coming in Monday. So read it in the Sunday Boston Globe. Why do fans ignore women's pro sports? Not only is she going to whine, I hope you are, Shira, but she has solutions, and she'll describe them to us on Monday. Shira Springer from the Globe,
hey,
thank you
for calling in, Shira. We'll talk to you again next week.
You know, before you say before you say what's coming up, since earlier in the show at 11 o'clock, we were talking about how the House of Commons is meeting as a legislative body should to discuss going to war, as opposed to our Congress, which is sitting home raising money. The vote was 524-43 in favor of David, Prime Minister David Cameron's resolution.
Well, good. I'm glad that they're with us, even though I'm worried about any of us being there. But anyway, up next, we're going to talk with Callie Crossley. She joins us for a take on the week headlines. Keep your dial on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio. Callie Crossley, up next.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan here with us in Studio 3, as she is every Friday, is the host of Under the Radar with Callie Crossley. You can hear it Sunday night, and that would be, needless to say, Callie Crossley. Hi there, Callie.
Hi, Jim. Hi, Marjorie.
Hello, Callie Crossley. Now, before we get to what we're going to talk about, I just want to ask you this, because you were here when we were talking about Derek Jeter. When I think of a woman I know that is sort of one of the banners across her forehead is, I am not a sports fan. I don't care. Wake me when it's over. What do you think about Derek Jeter?
I've come to think he's great. I have to confess that I was confusing him with the other guy that was in trouble. I said, why do they keep praising this guy? And then I realized, oh, that's the wrong guy. So anyway, no, he seems to have comported himself very well. I'm very impressed and impressed with how the fans treated him. So good story all around.
Okay.
Callie said to me before she came in, she said, is he the one in the elevator or is he the... No, she didn't, but I was pretty close.
Let's move on to something else. What do you think about our Governor Deval Patrick? He says he's not going to be the next Attorney General. Is he going to be the next Attorney General?
No. If I'm Deval Patrick, I do what I said I'm going to do, which is go out here and make some income and get away from this stuff. And that doesn't mean to say I don't think he's not coming back, because he's got that super PAC, you know, or that PAC or whatever, that's just sitting there quietly.
Excuse me. What? Excuse me.
Breaking
if
news.
You listen earlier, last night I had John Walsh on my show. And John Walsh, you know, is this brilliant strategist. He was campaign manager for Deval Patrick, chair of the State Democratic Committee. He left the chairmanship to become the executive director of Deval Patrick's Together PAC. I said to him last night, fairly facetiously, because I knew what the answer was going to be, even though I was wrong, so what are you doing if he's getting out of politics? You're shutting down the Together PAC right after the end of his term? And he looked at me and he said, yes.
Wow.
And
okay,
I said,
so
no, wait a second.
News.
I said, seriously? And he said, yes, we're shutting it down. We said we were. And we're doing it.
Now, that's breaking news.
We broached that with Brian McGrory a couple of minutes ago. I don't know what that means. See, I think that I agree with you that Deval Patrick's position is, I don't want to do this. I want to make some money. I want some relief out of the public eye. And I'll probably come back in
later.
And not so distant. The one question that hasn't been asked, well, we all asked them ages ago, but not recently, even though you don't want to do it, when the President of the United States, who you have colossal respect for, says, Deval, I need you. For the last 2 years, you think he says no to that?
No, I think he says no. I think he says, love you, guy. Good luck with that. I got something else I need to do right now. And I think you'll understand that, you know, I want to have a moment to myself before I figure out what I might want to do. I absolutely think he says, thank you, and I'm honored. See ya.
And I'm the president. I'd say, nice try, Deval.
Yeah.
When do you want to
start? Let's have lunch next time
in
Martha's Vineyard. I don't think he does it. I don't.
Let's talk about the guy he's succeeding, who got a lot of praise yesterday, but I think has a mixed record after 6 years. Here's outgoing Attorney General Eric Holder. You heard this story, but it's pretty powerful, describing times when he was racially profiled.
When I was pulled over twice and my car searched on the New Jersey Turnpike, when I'm sure I wasn't speeding, or when I was stopped by a police officer while simply running to catch a movie at night in Georgetown in Washington, D.C. I was, at the time of that last incident, a federal prosecutor.
And you probably heard him tell the exact same story when he went to Ferguson, Missouri a couple of weeks ago, which I think was pretty powerful in attempting to show the Department of Justice gets what you're living through. What's your assessment almost after the fact of 6 years of Eric Holder?
I think that he was very focused on what he thought would be the important task at hand. And one of the important tasks was really to make that Justice Department, you know, do justice. And one of the toughest areas that we do justice in this country has to do with race. And, you know, that's just the way it is. And so for him to have to put his neck out there and say, you know what, the Justice Department's going to have to investigate these scenarios in Ferguson and elsewhere. And by the way, we're still waiting for them to announce where they're going to go to some of these cities coming up where there have been issues. You know, it's pretty brave. You could just as easily do some other stuff. which is, you know, that you need to pay attention to as well, and not take the heat for that. But he put his neck out there to do it, and I got to, you know, give him some props for that. Could he have done some things more artfully, as they say, you know, in political speak? Perhaps so. I think the piece that Politico's Glenn Thrush did to really talk about, you know, sort of his trying to find his footing politically mm-hmm. in order to do his job was very insightful, because you realize, wow, there is what if you're in the government and you are at a high position as he is and you're trying to do certain controversial for some, you know, take care of some, put your attention to that, you have got to know politics.
Let me just say, the place, I want to comment on what you just said, but the place where I think I had a lot of problem with them is, well, lots of fines on Wall Street, not one single prosecution. That's a problem.
That's a fair criticism.
Subpoenaing of journalists, apparently, according to civil libertarians, at a record level was a problem.
Absolutely.
Signing off on NSA snooping on innocent Americans, a problem. However, one of the things he took the most heat for, I thought was one of the most courageous things he said. Shortly after taking office, he described all of us as a nation of cowards. And he was talking about our unwillingness to confront issues of race, which was so boldly and honest. It was insane. And there was huge heat, including from the—
I never understood why that reaction was
because
so.
You're not supposed to be that raw and honest. In fact, my understanding from having read is the Obama administration himself was unhappy with him because he went as far as he did on that issue. I thought it was perfect.
You know, the Obama administration and President Obama worked very hard during his campaign and then later really not to address race head on. And by the way, let's just go back
except with the Reverend Wright speech.
Yes,
one
but
exception.
That but he was forced but he
to.
Had to.
Yeah,
he
correct.
Had to.
You're right.
Okay, but and somebody did, and I'm sorry, I can't remember the name of the reporters now, a brilliant story in the middle of the campaign, which was not that they wanted to have happen at all. They tried to block it. This was 2008, about the racial incidents around the door-to-door canvassing, mm-hmm. Particularly around the white volunteers for Obama. They tried to squash that six ways from Sunday. So my point is that this is not a subject matter he wants to talk to in that way unless he must. And that's the stand he had to take to get where he got. So, okay.
You mean Obama.
President
Obama. To be
Obama.
Reelected
yes.
or elected in the
so
first
Eric
place.
So Eric Holder says about all of us, by the way, and somehow it was taken to be that he was identifying certain segments of the population and not all of us. He said all of us. That included himself.
I agree with you completely.
I don't understand.
Yeah. Well, I often thought in some ways on civil rights stuff and race stuff and sentencing, which he was so great on because African-Americans receive such longer sentences than anybody else.
For the you same know, crimes.
For the same
whites,
crimes,
yeah.
exactly. And in a totally unfair way, obviously. That he was almost the surrogate of Obama. He was doing...
Oh, he was Luther.
I agree with
what
it.
What Obama could not do
yes.
because
yes.
he was appointed
he was
as
Luther.
Opposed to having to get elected.
Let me tell people, if they're yeah. not familiar with Key and Peele, they're a comedy duo. They do a very satirical whole thing, a skit in which one of them plays President Obama and the other plays a character called Luther, who is his anger translator.
Yeah.
And what Luther says, I believe, is what he'd like to say, but never could.
Yeah, exactly, exactly. So let's move on to this big brouhaha surrounding this piece by Alexandra Stanley, who's a longtime television writer in the New York Times. She wrote it about Shonda Rhimes and was involving the angry black woman line, the you know what hit the fan. Before we even get to the angry black woman part, who is Shonda Rhimes? What's her claim to fame?
Shonda Rhimes is the only African American showrunner in Hollywood. She is the creator, writer behind Private Practice, Grey's Anatomy, Scandal, and now she's not the head person on How to Get Away with Murder, which is something that Alexandra Stanley did not get clear. She is the executive producer of How to Get Away with Murder, which is starring Viola Davis. She has a lot of power. Her claim to fame in these days and times is that she has made certain that her casts are multiracial. So there's all kinds of folks in there doing all kinds of things. And so for her to be denigrated, and I use that word advisedly, to being someone who is an angry black woman, which, by the way, she is not, and then have the rest of the whole piece be based on some false narrative, complete with inaccuracies about who she was and what she does, from the New York Times is disgusting. I have to say there's
can I read the opening line, by
yes,
the way, just
please.
So people...
Yes.
For people
I was about
who,
to do that.
Oh, well, then do
yeah.
it. Go
yes.
ahead. Read the opening line.
The opening line of Alexander Stanley's piece. When Shonda Rhimes writes her autobiography, it should be called How to Get Away with Being an Angry Black Woman. And then it goes on from there. I was about to say that there's been a lot written about this, but the person that I think speaks for me and has said all that needs to be said so beautifully in response to this ridiculousness is Kara Brown of the website Jezebel. She goes on to say, if you're using a racist stereotype as a legitimate description of your subject in the very first line, the descent into aggressive stupidity cannot be far.
And by the way, the public editor who's, what's her name, Margaret, whatever her name is,
Sullivan,
has said it's provoked a huge amount of response, including issues of is the time. The new editor, obviously, is an African-American, but there's very little diversity. And it's sparked that. But I want to get back to Alessandra Stanley for a second. I have to say I've been a huge fan of hers for years, one of my favorite television writers. Two paragraphs down, Kelly Crossley, from saying when Shonda Rhimes writes her autobiography, it should be called How to Get Away with Being an Angry Black Woman. She says her women, meaning Rhimes women, are authority figures with sharp minds, potent libidos, who are respected, even haughty members of the ruling elite, not maids or nurses or office workers. I mean, she basically goes on after that line that I know ignited a lot of anger to praise Rhyme for her honesty, her strength, her skills. And it seems to me a lot of the criticism heaped on Stanley has ignored what I think was her basic message. This woman is one of a kind and really, really good. Do you not
get that? She trampled a taboo. That was her line that even Michelle Obama couldn't.
Two things. First of all, she says her women, and they're only defined as the black women because Alexander Stanley had a narrative in this ridiculous piece. She never describes all of the other women which Shonda Rhimes created and write for, and nor did she point out that Shonda Rhimes herself has said, the character I identify with is Christine Yang. That's my identification. But let me read Kara Brown. So brilliant.
Intent, this is the Jezebel person?
This is the Jezebel person. Intent is not impact. Intent is not impact. In terms of importance and relevancy here, your intention is secondary at best, and qualifying your apology with, this was Alexander Stanley in response, well, I didn't mean it, doesn't exactly bolster your sincerity. And let me point out again, journalistically, she has facts wrong. We're not even talking about her opinion well, about it. Her facts are incorrect.
So what's the takeaway here? Okay, the facts were wrong, and obviously that's the problem. You don't want the facts to be wrong. But is it that Alexander Stanley's a racist, or is this that this was some terrible racist piece by the New York Times, or that black people and white people see this differently, or what?
Well, actually, black people and white people don't see it differently. A Hollywood Reporter, who knew to call them a journalistic enterprise, actually went to ask 30 people in Hollywood, how do you view Shonda Rhimes? Yeah. In three words.
Right.
And not one of them used angry or black woman. They had other qualities to raise, which is her import here. So the problem is, and I'm not describing Alexander Stanley as a racist, by the way. I don't know who she is. Here's what I know is that she wrote this piece inaccurately through the lens of a racist stereotype. You got nowhere to go from there. You can't come back. So all I can say is Shonda Rhimes herself said, I have been too busy being angry and a black woman. It takes up a lot of time, so I couldn't really respond to it.
Do you know her, by the way?
No, I wouldn't. I love to.
Yeah.
Who wouldn't like to
go
know
ahead.
Her?
I'm sorry.
You know?
Yeah.
But my point is that her narrative was so flawed, that's a nice word I can use here, as to make all the rest of us angry black women. You know, I mean, it's just ridiculous because this woman has done so much. She is admired by so many, and she's earned it. And to be reduced to three stereotypical words is ridiculous. I don't care what your stupid intent was.
You know,
so to
I
quote
just,
Martha Coakley, you have an open mind on the
I
issue,
have an
obviously.
Open mind on the issue.
How is the show, by the way? And all you know, with one thing that is lost in translation here, this show that she's describing is How to Get Away with Murder, and obviously it's Viola Davis who's the star of this. How is the show? Do we know? Has anybody seen this thing?
Yeah, the show aired last night, and just to let you know, because Marjorie mentioned the editors and the fact, and I guess you did too, that this passed through three editors. The culture editor has apologized, saying, we obviously have a blind spot, and we're missing something, not having another voice at the table to look at this. Just to let you know what this means, People Magazine last night, their whoever tweets for them, tweeted, waiting for Viola Davis to say, you is kind, you is patient, which is a line from her role in The Help, playing a maid. This is how ingrained this stuff is. Are you kidding me? Really? Are you kidding me?
Yeah.
You know, I just...
Well, that means we have to go to the Hollywood Reporter as our primary journalistic news source on these issues.
But how is the show? The show's been touted as being very good.
Uh-huh.
And by the way, the creator
thing.
Of that show is not Shonda Rhimes, as is inaccurately
said. If she had not started this with the lead she had, when Shonda Rhimes writes her autobiography, it should be called How to Get Away with Being an Angry Black Woman. If she had...
No, the rest of it's messed up, too.
Okay.
Because she goes on to try to fit this narrative that she starts with by forcing in only the black characters, which is not who Shonda Rhimes is.
Okay.
If you're writing about Shonda Rhimes as a person to be, what she says, to be admired, who has achieved a certain amount of success, not a certain amount, a huge amount of success, all of Thursday is her shows.
But the one last thing I want to ask you about this is one of the things I thought, because I'm not familiar with a lot of these TV shows, is
that... You don't watch Scandal? Oh, my God.
No, I don't.
Okay.
But that she was talking about how we used to portray black women a certain way on television. Now there are all these women. They're not Claire Huxtable, the nice wife of Bill Cosby, or they're not, you know, like The Help, which was a movie, but it was a really enraging movie. You know, the white woman comes in and rescues everybody. But that we're showing really powerful, strong, non-stereotypical, educated, hotshot black women on television.
She is doing really strong, non-stereotypical, educated white women. But that's the point, though. If you're writing a piece about her and her work, you have started off wrong. You have not started off to embrace the body of her work.
But is that, are white strong, powerful women as new as black strong, powerful women?
That's not the point. The point is you're writing about her and critiquing, allegedly, her body of work and what she has achieved. And you missed the point.
Can I tell you something, though? The one place where I disagree with you, Kelly, I think maybe one and a half places, but one place, when you answered Marjorie's question about if the first line were not there and the rest of the story was as it was, maybe there would have been some upset. But in my opinion, I'm not taking anything away from the first line, but the first line is so powerful and so in your face that I think that's what
I would disagree with you only to say that when Margaret Sullivan, before she wrote her public editor of the New York Times, before she wrote her full response, she also did a shorter blog post and she quoted from some black women who had written her to say, really? That all of us are reduced to this? And then you followed up in the story with, you know, and named very specific pieces of the rest of how she wrote it to say, this is horrible. From the New York Times, I expect better, which is what Margaret Sullivan said. By the way, I think her hands were tied in the response that she gave because it was a little milquetoasty, which is not how she comes across normally.
And public editor, for those who don't know, is like the ombudsman.
She did the best she could do going to get the information that she got. But, you know, I think it required more, and she said she was going to stay on it. So
could you do me a favor? When you go upstairs, if you have a minute, can you cancel my subscription to the Times and subscribe me to the Hollywood Reporter?
I'll do that.
Before Jezebel is a fun website, I must say.
It's some really great writers and some insightful ones.
And a lot of young women with a whole different perspective.
Exactly.
On feminism and the state of women and all that kind of
stuff. So what are you doing under the radar? I know, because it's been leaked, that you're celebrating an incredible woman who received some of the recognition that her work deserves.
Absolutely. Mary Bonato is one of the 21 MacArthur Genius Awardees in the 2014 class. We do a series on Under the Radar called The Genius Next Door to reflect the geniuses who live in New England, and she's one of them. And so we're having a wonderful conversation with her. Her light is, you know, huge, but so often she's not recognized for the work that she's done. People know her work, but they don't know her name.
Yeah.
So this is an opportunity for us to have a longer conversation with her. And even in that conversation, you know, she's so humble and, well, everybody did it and worked together. And that's true. But I have to say that this is a situation where some people have called her Thurgood Marshall. And I agree with that.
Based on not just
making that connection because it seems surfacey, but really about how she did her political strategy mirrors what Thurgood Marshall did with a team of civil rights lawyers. So I have to say
that at the NAACP Legal Defense Fund before his Supreme Court justice.
So this is accurate.
Let me just add one thing. Sue O'Connell, who obviously is the publisher of Bay Windows, is with us, I don't know, yesterday, the day before, whatever it is, and we were talking briefly about Bonato. And she said outright that had Mary Bonato not existed, there would probably not be gay marriage in the United States in 2014. That's pretty powerful stuff.
Yeah, she did a brilliant job, including picking the right people to lead the charge.
Which is a huge part of the thing.
Right,
but thinking long term. Mm-hmm. See, because, you know, all of us, we're like, change now, change now. And you got to give the credit to somebody who says, this is going to be a piece by piece, uphill by uphill kind of fight. Also, what I love about the MacArthur Awards, I know they hate being called the Genius Awards, they recognize people who are just doing what they do. They're continuing to work on what they believe in. They're just going about their business. And out of somewhere, somebody says, you should be noticed for this.
You know what I love about them? Is they don't just recognize you. They give you $250,000 to support your wonderful
work.
Maybe
that's the problem, Jim, that you've been campaigning. Maybe you should just
stand
on the radar.
You know, it's all good things come. You know,
as okay.
Callie, great to see you. We'll be watching. I'm listening. Pardon
Crossley
me. Sunday
is
night.
Host of Under the Radar with Callie Crossley. You can catch her every Sunday night right here on 89.7 from 6 to 7. Thanks so much, Callie. You were on fire today, on fire, Callie
Crossley.
Well,
thank you. Oh, Callie, I'm sorry.
No, not you, Jim. Up next, we're going to stick with the Under the Radar theme. WGBH's Brian O'Donovan is here for a rundown of some of the lesser-known local music venues and upcoming shows. Most of them are right next door to us here in Cambridge. That's next on 89.7 WGBH, Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Here with us in Studio 3 to talk about upcoming shows and music venues you may not know about, but should, is GBH's Brian O'Donovan. As you know, Brian is host of A Celtic Sojourn. Brian, it has been far too long. Great to see you.
Great to see you guys. Last time I think we were talking about World Cup. Is that right?
We may have been talking about World Cup, but I have to say what is emblazoned in my soul for the rest of my natural life and beyond is the moment that may be my favorite moment in our year and a half here. When Tim Brennan from the Dropkick Murphys was playing, you were in the quiz, or I don't know what you were doing.
Yeah, it was
here.
News quiz, I think.
And you sang as he played. It was as good as 5 minutes of radio gets. So, Brian,
great.
It's great to see you.
It was so fun.
So, I visited Dublin for the first time ever, visited Ireland this winter, and I was really surprised when you go out to these bars. People would just come in off the street with their instruments and start playing. This happened to me like two or three times, which seems, I thought, wow, why doesn't it ever happen in the United States? But I think I miss out, obviously, on a lot of live music that's around here because you're talking about stuff I had no idea was going on.
Absolutely. Well, in the traditional music scene, which is what you're talking about in Dublin, there's a lot of that around here as well. Sessions, they're called. It's the language of spontaneous music. There's a repertoire that people know the world over, traditional musicians. So they come along with their instruments, they wander into usually a pub, and they start playing, and they know these tunes together. So it's a jam session. But it's very, very common around here. The Burren does it in Davis Square in Somerville, the Inman Square, the Druid is a great place for sessions. They're all over the place, and they're really
no
terrific.
Idea.
You know, Brian, we're going to talk. We're going to talk about some venues and some bands that you think people shouldn't miss in smaller venues. And by the way, seeing somebody who's really great when you're close to them is as good as it gets. But how big is that scene? We all know that if Springsteen comes to town or Taylor Swift comes to town or Keith Urban comes to town, the 60,000 seats could be sold out in 15 minutes. You used to work, obviously, out at Gillette and that thing. How popular are these venues?
Well, it's a very good point that you're asking there. These are small venues. They're intimate venues, and what's going on in them is really, really interesting. But it's by definition small. It's under the radar screen. But what I've become over the last few years is really a live music advocate, just pushing people to get off the couch, turn off Netflix, and just go and see people in the flesh performing what they're doing. And I don't care what the genre is, traditional, rock and roll, jazz, classical music, there is nothing like traditional music. Even what we do on the radio, what I do on the radio on Saturday afternoons, I declare on radio is a distant second best to actually seeing the performance.
So take
live.
Us to a venue. What's the first? We're going to do Cambridge today, right?
Yes,
we'll do other places in future get-togethers. Let's start in Cambridge. Pick a place and tell us about it.
There's a wealth there in Cambridge. One of my favorite places to go is called the Lizard Lounge.
Oh, yes.
Right on Mass Ave, under the restaurant known as Cambridge Common. And it's a small, classic little room. You know, you would swear you could have been in the 60s or the 70s. The stage is essentially a rug on the ground. And it holds about 90 people. And the best, just the best music goes on there, week in, week out. And we start with a group called Session Americana. And it's like what you talked about, Marjorie. This is a group that takes the session concept. They're sitting around tables. The microphones are hidden under the tables, so there is sound amplification. But these guys have a great designation. They work in incredible ways with rock and with folk. And they're made up of some of the best musicians in the Boston area. Let's take a listen to Session Americana, a great song that they wrote and often sing in an anthem-like fashion at the Lizard Lounge. Is a song about their beloved beer.
Out on the ocean, going through the motion, pulling on a rope in a big deep sea, sailing with the pirates, causing a commotion, thinking of the place that I'd rather be.
Beer town.
Gonna jump in a big brown river.
Beer town.
Gonna call that river.
That's where I'd like to live, Brian.
See,
let me tell you.
Isn't it? It's just a Session Americana, and this is their term, not mine. They were called a rock band in a teacup, are possibly a folk band in a whiskey bottle. You take your choice.
Do they show up? Is this like they're there every Tuesday night? What do they do? How does this work?
The Lizard Lounge has a terrific system called residency, where a group like Session Americana will go there and be there every Tuesday night for a month, or Tuesday night for two months. So you've got a chance to see them and check out their schedule. Dennis Brennan is another one that has a residency there. He is a rocker who's been around here for decades. And when you go and see these musicians in the flesh, if you haven't heard them before, and a lot of people know these musicians, but if you haven't heard them before, you go, why isn't Dennis Brennan playing Gillette Stadium or the equivalent? Because he's every bit as good as Bruce Springsteen. It's just whatever the vagaries of the industry has not taken these great talents to those heights.
How, if you go to the Lizard Lounge that seats 90 people, are you waiting for an hour and a half to get in, or you have to get there 2 hours before the performance starts, or what?
These days, Marjorie, you can buy tickets in advance. Tickets are relatively inexpensive, Okay. Probably somewhere around 10 to 15 bucks or 18 bucks. So getting them in advance is always desirable, because then you're not frozen up, because fire codes keep people out at the door. But they're just great venues. And again, getting off the couch, people who come, I urge to come to the Lizard Lounge, and they come, they go, why haven't we done this every week? Or why haven't we done it once a month at least?
And are these, for the most of the people who are in residency, to use that description, which I love, and I've never heard the term before in this context, it's so perfect. Are these people who play all the time? Are they people who play and have jobs during the day? Because the reality is they're not playing 10,000-seat venues. They're playing 90-seat venues. What's the deal with them?
Well, it's exactly that. It's a mixture. So some of them are professional musicians in that they cobble together a life in music. Mm-hmm. So it might be performance combined with teaching, combined with playing on other people's albums or being engineers themselves. And some of them work in hardware stores or pumping gas, or some of them are teachers and lawyers and psychiatrists. I mean, seriously, it runs the whole gamut, but they love to play music. They're professionals in what they do, and they bring amazing art to the Boston area. We're blessed with the talent that we have in this area.
Well, you just said Dennis Brennan reminds you of the great, he has a talent for the great Bruce Springsteen that Jim rhapsodizes about all the time. Can we hear a little bit of this Dennis Brennan character?
Here's Dennis Brennan from his last album. He's got a new one coming out shortly, and he's in residence at the Lizard Lounge every Wednesday night.
Know these people?
Yes.
And how long is Dennis Brennan? You said he's been around for a long time?
That's a good question, but I think you're probably my age. So
really?
That's a long time. You know, he's in his 50s, but still a rocker and still able to crank it. And honestly, if you go to see Dennis Brennan, you're just going to be blown away.
Also, let me say,
he's not a psychiatrist in his spare time, I assume.
He's a psychiatrist in that he writes songs about psychiatric issues.
What does he do? Do you know?
He actually works in a hardware store in Harvard Square as well.
Oh,
he's
my
often
God.
Not Pill Hardware. He doesn't work at Pill Hardware, does he?
He works at the one right in Harvard Square. What's the name
Pill
of it?
Pill Hardware. That's right in Harvard Square.
Yeah,
it is
the one across from the Gap and the
Yes,
Hotel.
That's it. That's unbelievable. That just is frightening. Let me just tell you, I want to say what I said again, even though I don't go nearly enough. The experience of being close to a musician
Absolutely.
Who has talent. I had an experience which has nothing to do with this, but I'm going to say it anyway.
This is a Bruce Springsteen story?
No, this is a Neil Young story. One of my favorite performers, one of the most brilliant people of all time, which sort of relates
Great
to
musician.
This. A friend of mine runs something called Farm Aid, and mm-hmm. I took my daughter and I went to Farm Aid in Milwaukee.
Willie Nelson was very much involved.
Yeah, Willie Nelson, this woman, founded this thing, Carolyn Mugar. And we go out there, and Friday night before the Farm Aid concert, you know, with Mellencamp and Neil Young and Dave Matthews, and who's the fourth? Oh, Willie Nelson, of course. Mm-hmm. They're doing their sound check things. And we sit in the front row of an empty Milwaukee stadium, 45,000 seats. There are like 10 of us there, while Neil Young plays Southern Man. And I'm not equating Dennis Brennan, but being close to someone who's got talent.
It's
phenomenal. It is different from anything you can possibly imagine.
And what you're hitting on is the reason why I'm an advocate for live music is because you sense that. You sense that in the musicians. You watch the interplay. It's a real artistic adventure. And again, I can't encourage people strongly enough to just go out and see music, support music. A lot of these guys are doing it for the sake of pure art. And they're absolutely fabulous. And these clubs are supporting them. And we're blessed in the Boston area more than any other city, perhaps. Maybe New York, maybe Chicago is comparable. But we're blessed with an abundance of talent here that's absolutely off the charts.
So there's affordable. Still more at the Lizard Lounge, correct?
Oh, that's great. Well, they stay on...
You've been in the Lizard Lounge, by the way?
I've driven past it a million times.
I've had beer on the first floor, and the beer is great. And I'm embarrassed to say I've never gone
Let's
down
go
on
downstairs.
Floor.
I'll introduce you to some of these guys in the flesh. Roy Sludge, one of my favorite rockabilly characters who plays in this area and sings. He's got an impossible baritone voice. Let's take a listen to him on one of his tracks. He also writes his own music, writes original rockabilly, and he sounds like this.
Well, I drive all over this country, roaming from town to town. When day is done, I'm gonna have my fun. I'll pick them up and put them down. Well, I'll flirt with some old waitress, try to push my luck. But when push comes to shove, I'm too tired for love, cause I'm too drunk to try.
Which is the
that
name
is
of the
great.
Song. You know what I love about it? The image of, what's his name, Roy Sludge?
Roy Sludge.
Playing in Harvard Square. Again, if you don't know, this is Mass Ave. It's about 100 yards out of Harvard Square on the way to Porter Square. That is great. Is he a local or what is
He's
he?
He's a local, well-known musician here locally. Attracts a crowd that loves him. Anybody who sees him that hasn't heard of him goes, holy macaroni, what are we watching here? Just a great talent and a really fun guy to go and see. And he plays Lizard Lounge. He plays a lot of other places. Like there's a new place called the Beat Hotel. And there's a new place
Harvard Square as well.
In Harvard Square as well. And there's a festival coming up, a Free Americana festival
what
coming
does that
up
mean?
This weekend. It's this type of music that has a general kind of umbrella on it. It's really undefined, but it has an American bass, a jazz, a blues, a bluegrass, a rockabilly, country kind of influence on it, contemporary singer-songwriter music, Appalachian. And it all blends together into the new music that has created entities like Mumford & Sons, who sold millions
them.
Of records,
yeah.
for example. So there's a festival in Harvard Square, absolutely free this weekend, and go and check it out.
Where
oh,
in Harvard,
a gorgeous
where in Harvard
day,
Square?
Right
too.
All around Harvard Square. They closed down some of the streets, big stage right in front of
oh
the coop.
God. And it's 80 degrees and sunny.
Yeah.
Saturday
it's
going to
be gorgeous.
But it's going to be gorgeous. You know, and it's great that people will go and see these people because you know how if you go to a bar, like even like a snazzy, nice bar, like the Four Seasons used to have a piano player in there, and you'd have this incredibly talented pianist and nobody was listening to them. I mean, I just don't know how you do that. And at least these people are getting listened to when they're performing.
They are, and they've got amplification on their side as well. So if somebody's talking, they can go higher than them by cranking it up to 11.
Oh, used to kill me.
It is great. It is really a terrific scene. And there's so many others. The Lily Pad is another place that I just want to reference because people don't know about this little club. It's in Inman Square, and it's democracy in action for music because people rent it out. Sometimes they do three shows a night, and it will veer from classical quartet of kids who've just graduated from the conservatory all the ways to some acid post-punk punk, whatever that means. I'm making that up as I go along. But just something that's completely a different type of rock that blasts the walls of the place out. And it really is just an amazing place. That's the lily pad right in Inman
Square. I've never
heard
of it. By the way, that's right.
Of course,
you.
I live in Inman Square. By the way, that's the voice of Brian O'Donovan, as if you didn't know, of Celtic Sojourn. You know, the other place in Inman Square, which I want to mention, is Ryle's, which I'm sure is on your list. The beauty of Ryle's, not only do they do this music there, you can't sort of believe in the place. One of my favorite things is I drive by it every night. The whole wall is windows. It's both a restaurant, a bar.
Oh,
and
yeah.
Some nights they do salsa lessons. Other nights they have bands. And the beauty of this is when you drive by, you don't hear the music if you're outside.
See it
you just see That's exactly. True. You see it happening,
it's really
and it is really whether it's the salsa dancing or it's the musicians. How high quality? What kind of quality? By the way, they're owned by the people who own the S&S Deli, which mm-hmm. is rather famous in Inman Square. How high is the quality of what they get there?
Very, very high, and it's jazz, and it's one of the few jazz clubs in still going, especially in Cambridge, especially in a kind of a bar restaurant mm-hmm. format as you described. So I am just amazed that Ryle's is still going in this day and age with that format, but it is, and long may it be so. And as you point out, it's as much community center as it is club. Great performances, but also lessons and a very kind of invitational, welcoming atmosphere around it. And anybody that you see at Ryle's, really, just the fact they're playing in Ryle's is a quality bar. They've risen to a certain level.
What night is salsa night again?
I think it's Tuesday night.
The reason you cannot miss this, beyond the fact that you see people dancing, mostly beginners who don't know the music, is you'll have a couple who are tripping the proverbial light fantastic next to a couple of beginners, you know, each of whom are in their 70s who decided they want. It is a wonderful image. They could actually make a movie out of it. What other music they have is for us, Brian O'Donovan?
We've got another place called Bull McCabe's, which is in Union Square, and they've got a great festival coming up. They're known for their music as well. Tiny little place. Used to be called Chapter 11 years ago. It went through various iterations.
Union Square is about the hottest place going, by the
Seriously, way. Seriously, now. That's the new place. There's some great clubs over there.
Right over the border from Cambridge
into Somerville. Yeah. Exactly. And they're talking about putting a subway stop there, so it's going to change pretty quickly as well in more dramatic fashion. But at Bull McCabe's, great festival concept. It's called Roots to Reggae. One of my favorite rockers in the area. He's from the north of Ireland. His name's Christian McNeil, and he might remind you in this piece of another famous rocker from the north of Ireland.
Summer's not alone. All alone, without a friend to call upon. You should go hear your favorite band and hope they play your favorite song.
I hope we're talking Van Morrison.
Yeah.
Is that what we're talking
yeah,
about?
Yeah, absolutely. You'd think it was Van Morrison.
How could we not be? Just a great, and this is Christian's own stuff, and he's just a great, great musician around who's going to be performing at the Bull McCabe's Roots to Reggae Festival.
You know, by the way, you know, when I keep hearing these, every single one you mention, I'm saying to myself, I live right in the middle of what you're talking about.
Mm-hmm.
And other than Ryle's, I know nothing about any of this. Is it the same 100 people who go from, I don't mean that critically, I mean it observationally. Is it the same 100 or 200 people that go from place to place to place who actually appreciate what's there as opposed to those of us who are, it's in our midst and we're clueless?
In fairness, there's a lot of that. I mean, there's a group of crazy people like me who kind of look to going out three or four nights a week to see these bands mm-hmm. and hear them in the flesh. So I'm dedicated to it. So we see a lot of the same faces. Then there's a group that, you know, likes a particular artist, so they'll follow them around. But Jim, you're in the majority, actually. You're the
clueless
majority
norm.
People, clueless people who just stay in their house. Sorry, I mean that in an affectionate way. But they stay in their houses and just don't adventure out. If they don't know the band, they're worried that they won't like it, that it'll be uncomfortable, that it'll be too expensive, too loud, whatever it is. But again, just enjoying this city for what it is, the wonderful city it is, go out and support live music.
You know, Brian O'Donovan, I don't know how well you know any of these musicians, but you wonder whether when you hear somebody that just sounds just like Van Morrison, sounds terrific, how bitter you might be if, you know, you're not raking in the millions of dollars and playing at Gillette Stadium?
Very good question, actually, Marjorie. It really is. And it's a transitional period in every musician's life when they get to the point they've got the ambitions as younger people, perhaps, and have giving it the good old whack, and suddenly they find themselves playing in smaller clubs. But the vast majority of these guys are very, very happy with what they do, and they're dedicated to it. And that's the lack of bitterness, quite frankly, and cynicism is a feature of the music around here. Notice as well that I'm dealing with a generation, perhaps an older generation. There's plenty of young music going on in the Boston area that's very, very well supported by a younger generation. I'm talking about slightly older people who tend to stay indoors. I'm talking about those people pushing them out to see these great bands who are still creating great art.
You know, I'm very disappointed in you, brother, Donovan, because you're my go-to source on these kinds of things. You mentioned Van Morrison.
Yes.
And we're talking about Cambridge. What great song did Van Morrison write when he was living in Cambridge? Not only living in Cambridge, but living on Green Street, where I used to live, right behind the YMCA.
Well, the one that references the stadium, right?
Which is?
Underneath the stadium.
Well, I don't know. One of our people, I thought it was Brown Eyed Girl, which is one
That's
of the greatest songs.
The stadium. That's
what's, exactly oh, is that what it is? The same?
Yeah,
oh, that
Brown
is.
Brown Eyed Girl. Yeah, okay. Rolling around underneath the stadium.
And the stadium is,
of course, that's right.
He's referring to Harvard Stadium.
Is he?
Apparently so. That's what I've always heard.
How exciting is that?
It is exciting.
It is really exciting.
YMCA. What? I thought you were going to say you wrote YMCA.
No.
You ever met him, by the way? I hear he's incredibly rude and impossible to deal with, is he?
He's a quirky guy. He's
quirky. Listen to you, quirky. So the answer is yes,
he is. He's interesting.
Okay, so treat us to one more great singer and one great tune before we go, Brian.
Well, again, I just have people watch out for the great guitarist Ryan Montplow. Jennifer Kimball lives in Inman Square area. Sarah Siskind, Lyle Brewer, Barnes Whitfield. All of these musicians are in our midst. Coming up this weekend, though, there's a thing called iFest, which is an Irish kind of culinary lifestyle festival going on at the World Trade Center in Boston.
Really?
And they're bringing a very interesting, almost like a kind of theatrical performance artist from Ireland. His name is Jack Lukeman, but he is now known as Jack L. And we're going to listen to a piece, his take on the famous song, I Think It's Going to Rain Today.
Broken windows and hallways, pale dead moon in the sky, strings gray, human kindness overflowing, and I think it's gonna rain today.
I am buying that at 2 o'clock. That
Isn't
is
that
truly
it?
Beautiful. That
Just
is
there's
really
an emotion
beautiful.
Behind it. A great interpretation.
Wow.
But that's going on and coming up in the Regent Theatre. There's a reunion of some great rock bands through the last 50 years in the Boston area. So there's just so much going on. I get excited.
Is there a central place where all this is listed? Where do you look for all this?
You call Brian O'Donovan Sell and he'll tell you.
That's exactly right. You have to be a little creative in going after that. A site called Bands in Town is pretty good.
Bands in Town.
Looking at the Globe and looking at other calendar listings and just being active with it and asking around what's happening.
Brian, we want to do more of this.
That was terrific.
Yeah, we'll do more.
Just swooning over there.
We're going to bring you guys to one of those clubs sometime soon.
Absolutely. I mean, they're 5 minutes away. Brian is the host of Celtic Sojourn. You can catch him Saturday afternoons at 3 o'clock right here on 89.7. It's an absolutely great show that you do every Saturday. I love being in the car and being in the house and having you on in the background while I'm doing my exciting laundry and dishwasher emptying and all
Listen
that kind
to
of
this
stuff.
Song, but
it's
this
great.
Is really great.
Coming up, it is time for Open Mic with Emily Rooney. For that and her list of grievances and observations, keep her dial on 89.7 WGBH Boston Public Radio.
And I think it's gonna rain today. Lonely, so lonely. Tin can at my feet, I think I'll kick it down.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. Here with us in studio... Oh, by the way, I'm Jim Brown, and she's Marjorie Egan. I forgot that part. And here with us in Studio 3 for Open Mic, and of course her famous list of, I guess, obsessions, observations, whatever, is Emily Rooney. Hi there, Emily.
Hey, Jim. Hey, Marge.
Hello, Emily Rooney. So let's start with the Tsarnaev case. Big developments on the change of venue. It's not going to happen, apparently.
Yeah. I'm not surprised.
Is that good?
It's very, very rare
it
you
is.
See a change of venue. And it's unfair.
And you really think
Wait, which is unfair, that there's not a change in venue?
No, it's unfair to the people who want to be able to participate in the trial, be there.
If there were a change in
exactly.
venue.
Exactly.
Well, you know what I've always thought?
It's not going to make any difference.
You
in
hear this,
case. This
all the time from defense lawyers. We can't get a fair trial. We can't get a fair trial. Too much pre-trial publicity. But it is amazing how many people, they get in there. Maybe it's the seriousness of the courtroom or the seriousness of taking their job. Is with responsibility as they should, which is a great thing. I think jurors do a great job overcoming the biases.
You think of all the unbelievable cases we've had in Boston from Paul Shanley.
Yes.
The priest, for those who don't remember.
Abused a little boy.
Whitey Bulger. And it always, you never can forget how out of it so many people are. A lot of people don't pay any attention to anything.
None.
Zarnaya's name would probably not trip off the tongue of everybody in Boston. They'd know the marathon bomber, but they wouldn't be able to come up with his name.
Okay, my turn. Either of you ever served on a jury?
Yes.
Okay. I served on a jury once. And by the way, while everybody took it seriously, we were the classic jury that decided not to render our verdict, even though we had reached it. Until we got the free lunch from the state. Now you,
I thought that was me.
Well, no, it happens with everybody. Now let me tell you, I couldn't, with all due respect to, was a Judge O'Toole here. I couldn't disagree with him or you more. I'm totally sympathetic to the victims of this thing getting there. But by the way, a solution to that is to put the thing on television, as we've
Absolutely.
Discussed forever,
a disgrace,
which is
disgrace.
A total disgrace. By the way, it's a disgrace even if it's in Boston, yes. much less in Washington, D.C. Here's what O'Toole said. The Constitution does not obligate them to be, meaning wholly unaware of the marathon bombings. For those who don't know, and I'm sure most of you do out there, all you have to do is be able to make a fair decision right. based on what's presented. You can have biases as long as you can legit. However, here's what he said. It is sufficient if the juror can lay aside his impression or opinion and render a verdict based on the evidence presented in court. Well, I can't disagree with you, the second part of what you said, Emily, that anywhere there's going to be some bias. You think any juror who is from Greater Boston who lived through last April can set aside their impression or opinion and render a verdict based on the evidence presented in court?
Yes.
Everybody thinks this guy is guilty.
But
why do we even have a trial?
They think so.
Because the evidence which they will present in court will be overwhelming. The evidence is overwhelming. There's a death penalty aspect here, too, which ups the ante. And that's another thing, too, whether people that are going to sit in a jury can sit in a jury that's going to wind
can
up.
Can they lay aside their impressions and biases of this?
But Jim, nobody can in this region. Why would it be more difficult for people in New York City?
I'll tell you why. And you're a perfect example because you live two blocks from where this happened. We all drive down Boyle Street. Is there a time you drive down Boyle Street and cross the Forum and those other places where you don't say to yourself, oh my God, I can't believe what happened here just a year and a half ago? It is qualitatively different. And so I'm not saying it's a slam dunk, but this notion that it's going to be easy to find 12 jurors out of a pool of 5 million residents who are going to be able to lay aside their impressions.
I mean,
just BS to me.
They ended up moving the Tim McVeigh trial. And I'm not sure that would have made any
where
difference.
Where did they Same move thing. That? To Denver? Is that where it ended
Denver
up?
Denver. He was executed in Indiana, so
always Oklahoma
get
City was where, of course, the building
Obviously,
was.
Yeah.
They blew up the Morrow Federal Building. But it was moved.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
I was just going to say, I think it's perfectly fine. I think they will find a fair jury. I think this is all a bunch of defense bluster in almost every one of these
Rarely
trials.
Happens.
And by the way, one decision the judge did make to change things, which may not matter to most people, 2 month delay. So the trial's in early January rather than around election time, which I actually think is a pretty good thing.
Gives you more time, Jim, to get those cameras into the courtroom.
Well, you know, I know
it's
that
just it, outrageous.
Well, you know what's outrageous, and I think this is very much misunderstood. Our Congress could change it.
Most people don't know that.
Delegation here, and shame on every single one of them who have made no effort to change the law and put the pressure on the federal government so they allow these cameras in the courtroom because they could do it. There's been legislation filed on this, I think, since the early 2000s. Who's the senator from Iowa? Charles Grassley, I think his name is.
Charles Grassley, a Republican from Iowa. Yeah.
He started it. And the thing is that people should understand, first of all, there's going to be no room in this courtroom for the people.
They'll have a spillover.
They'll have a very small section. They will have a spillover, but those of us, and you've probably been in the spillover, and so have I, all you get to see in the spillover is a defendant sitting there.
It's terrible.
And maybe you don't get to see anything else.
Because it's not a switched camera feed.
You have people, and many of them may not want to go, but you have people, obviously, who have lost limbs, who've suffered tremendous physical injuries. They're going to have to drive to Boston, may or may not get into the courtroom because there's not going to be enough room for them and be in a spillover room. It's outrageous.
Can I add one element to that? While they obviously have top priority, I am being screwed here, too.
As a member of the public.
These, Tsarnaev is being prosecuted in my name and Emily's
correct.
And yours. I want to see this trial.
Yeah.
And I virtually everybody I know, or a mm-hmm. lot of people I know, want to see this trial. And let me just say one last thing about, which is not to excuse members of Congress at all. I guarantee you, if you polled the 535 members of this do-nothing mm-hmm. Congress, maybe 50 of them would even know
they
that
don't
they have
know.
The power.
I've called them.
They think it's
I've
the Supreme
them.
Court
I think
of the
it's
United States.
The Supreme Court. They have no idea. No. And you know what? They absolutely should be ashamed of themselves. Our delegation here in Massachusetts, every single one of them.
They should be championing this thing. I agree.
They should be championing.
Okay,
next.
Speaking of champion or non-champion, you're a big Red Sox fan, Emily.
Yes,
we know that.
I was supposed to go to the game last night, and then I got sidetracked.
Okay, whatever.
Really?
I don't want to know why.
The sidetrack was more fun than the game,
sure.
Emily.
Probably was.
So from last under Bobby Valentine to first, this shocking and wonderful World Series championship under John Farrell, the manager, to last. I don't even know if that's ever been done. They're going to finish last this year. Last to first to last. So what do you make of that, Emily Rooney, big Red Sox fan?
I mean, I think last year was the real anomaly, you know, coming back after that disastrous Bobby Valentine season. And everybody was in shock last year. Everybody, including Dan Shaughnessy from the Boston Globe, that they couldn't believe that they weren't going to have a collapse at some point. So this is more normative. This is kind of like this is kind of where we're used to being. I don't think we have the worst record. I think Houston or somebody like that.
Oh, well,
that
that's a consolation.
Yeah. So we're only 26 games back. They're like 27 or something like that.
26 games back.
But, you know, Margie and I have talked about this for years that we've been on radio. Here is my thesis about sports fans in this region. We would prefer, not with the Patriots, I think that's a different thing, but for the Red Sox, since the misery was for so long, obviously for 80-some years, as we well know, until that was done away with three times in a decade, I would say, even if they don't know it, the average Sox fan is happier when the Red Sox are horrible than when the Red Sox are great. Misery in this region about the Red Sox is epic.
That may be true for the diehard Sox fans, but for people like me and most of the fans, Red Sox Nation, there's something about it because it takes you through the fall. It's the extension
of
summer.
That's a good point.
And it's something to distract you, and it's exciting, and everybody's in it together like we were last year. I mean, I went to most of those games because I happened to have a pass, a press pass anyway.
Really?
But it was like, yeah. Representing WGBH, of course.
Wait a second. Okay, let's stay off the agenda here for a second. You have a WGBH press pass?
Well, wait a minute.
What
we
are you,
work.
A sports columnist or something?
We work for WGBH,
exactly.
too.
Exactly.
By the way, those passes are really hard to come by. So
they
every
are.
Year they just rubber stamp me. So it's me and I think Jared and one other person, Howard Powell. And if you try to change the names, they give you a hard time. So.
Jared Bowen, the
yes.
arts editor,
yes.
has a pass
he,
to the Red
he
Sox?
He beat you out,
we've
Jim.
Had it for about... 10 years.
And Howard's
more.
A camera guy. Obviously, you need a camera guy if you're doing something.
We do.
Are you ashamed at all about
not
this
all.
Or not? You're not in the slightest. So are you happier?
I'm your
when,
representative. For Red Sox.
You're doing. Are you happier when they're miserable or are you
no,
not?
No.
You
I liked it when they were miserable. You know why? Because you could get tickets to the game on game day. It was a beautiful day. It's 75 degrees. This would be a great night to go see the Red Sox. You could actually get in.
Yeah.
And then they started winning. You couldn't get in anymore.
Yeah.
So that's why I liked it better when they were losing.
No, but your point.
I go for the ambiance. You know, I don't really.
Yeah. But
I'm
your
not,
point about getting. We were discussing the other day how much we both can't stand fall because fall leads
so,
to winter and
so
it's so depressing. It really is. But it is. That is a very good point.
It
does get you through.
Summer and it gets you through till November 1st. And now
really,
we don't
is
have
that how long? Is that when the World Series
yes.
is? November? God, I had no idea.
No, it ends
this year, it
last
is in
week of October.
Well, I think no. I think this year, if they
well,
play seven
the
games, it could go
won,
into November.
2004, it went into November.
You know, it also fits the discussion we were having yesterday. One of the other reasons people love the extension is when you're bombing ISIS, when you have Khorasan coming to your shore, when you have Ebola spreading at a rapid rate.
Let's
thank God
worry
they're the
about
Red
how
Sox.
Fast the pitcher can pitch. I mean,
now,
it,
Emily,
doesn't matter.
Yes,
if I may, I was complaining and I'm still upset and big time about the fact that only 15% of the voters in Massachusetts turned out for the primary. Election day is 39 days away, and already. You're upset about something that is literally.
I know. And
well, what is
gonna,
it?
Some people are going to be offended by this, but I'm offended by it.
Go ahead.
They changed our polling places this year because they're having work done at the Boston Public Library. So they changed it to Old South Church, which is a beautiful, lovely institution downtown. But I don't want to go vote at a church. I'm uncomfortable voting in a church. First of all, I think there should be a separation of church and state. I went in there. on primary day, and there was organ music playing, and I said, I felt awkward. I felt uncomfortable. And the polling place woman said to me, really, really, we just love this. This is so wonderful. We feel so welcoming. And also, people are voting at St. Cecilia's this morning because that precinct was also used to vote at the Boston Public Library. But what she said to me, what was more interesting, was that they canvassed up and down the entire Back Bay trying to get someone, anyone, to take them as a polling place. Not the tannery, not like a shoe store, but any civic institution, and they couldn't find any, so they ended up at the churches. But you're looking at me weird.
No, I think it's weird.
I'm with you. I think it is weird as well, especially if the organ music is playing in the background. And I'm stunned, because usually schools, and as you say, other civic buildings, a library, or in Brookline, they have some recreation building where I voted in when the schools have been shut down.
There's lots of schools in the Back Bay.
Yeah, I don't understand why some of the schools have not stepped
up. A lot of them are private, but still.
Yeah.
We should tell the other part.
They don't want the hoi polloi in there, the private schools, you know what I mean? Emily, they don't want... Who knows?
I wasn't that upset about it until Emily said she had to light a candle before she voted, which I thought was... By the way, I'm embarrassed to say, I don't know if I've ever voted in a church. And
what about synagogues? Are those voting places too?
I bet people would protest. But I have to say, I hope I would have the same reaction
or
you
mosque?
Would. But if I didn't, you're
Can you imagine if people were voting in a mosque?
Tell me.
You know what?
People wouldn't
protest. Fans. People would be hysterical.
See?
But that has nothing to do with the religious nature of the establishment.
I'm telling you, people would go crazy if they had to vote in a mosque.
Because of the Muslim thing
and
the prejudice.
So what's the difference?
Well, the difference is you're objecting to the religion that is practiced there. You're objecting to the fact that any religion is practiced there. So why don't you call it, considering you're the most resourceful news person I know, how come you didn't call the election commissioner in Boston?
Maybe I'll get on that. Another story to tell in another time about power and control and how you can access change. That's for a later date.
It is.
Well, you know what's really weird, too? So many of these churches that have shut down have been turned into condominiums. I don't know. I mean, on the one hand, you do have the beautiful stained glass windows. On the other hand,
it's weird.
It would feel weird, you know, having your bathroom or your kitchen or something right where, you know, they were saying the body of Christ for like 150 years. You wouldn't know if this would be a good thing or not a good thing. You know what I mean? It might just
both
like
of my kids
a poltergeist kind
went
of
to a middle school that had been a church that then became a middle school or a K through 8 that is now an expensive condominium.
Did they have the stained glass windows in there?
I'd like to hear you two agree with me on this.
It's
creepy.
But by the way, don't you think the breakdown would be exactly the same kind of breakdown for those who are concerned about creches and those sort of things? I mean, it is an issue. And when people poo-poo it as being an anti-religious position, it is ridiculous. No. I mean, there is a separation.
Yeah.
So we're with you. Now, we've waited long enough. This is why we are here, and we assume it is why you listeners are here. Here it is.
It's so stupid. Stupid.
What?
I still don't believe it.
Oh, he should go to jail.
Typical. That's not possible. Are these people dumb? I don't
like
that one.
First of all,
I don't stutter.
Can I tell you something? No, you don't.
I do.
I know you so well, Emily, that I said, I hadn't heard it until just now, and I said Chelsea was telling me about the new sound upstairs, and I said, can I tell you something? Emily's not going to like this. In any case...
I don't stutter, so I don't get the joke.
Okay, fine. It's not a joke. Okay, Emily, let's... Here it is.
You're going to have to put the old one back.
We'll decide. It's not for now. Now, Emily, let's...
I'm going to let Emily rant for a few minutes about the new state.
I don't get it.
Can I explain it to you after the show? Now, Emily, is this list... let's get over that and move on. Emily, is this list thematic or is it not?
It is.
Thank you. Okay,
and
go
jumping
ahead.
Off from my voting place, I thought I'd come up with a list of cliches. These are cliches used by both the media and the candidates. And we are at the high season of cliches.
Yeah,
are we not?
We are.
I'm sure you could add to mine. I just have a partial list here. But every time I read the paper or listen to the radio, and us included, I think, my gosh, we fall back on this terminology. We just can't help ourselves.
I know.
I can't wait for this, by the way. I think I'm into this.
First of all, I couldn't believe that both Marty Walsh and Martha Coakley started off the season after the primer with calling it a new day. It's a new day? It is? Anyway, both of them said that. It's a new day. All right, now I'm just going to run through the rest of these. Virtual dead heat. Horse race. Neck and neck. Running neck and neck. Swing voters. I've never understood that. Undecideds. What are you talking about? Flip-flopping. Alarm bells. Staying on message. Resonating with voters. That's particularly ugly. Fix what's broken on, fill in the blank, Capitol Hill, Beacon Hill. The women's vote. Closing the gender gap. Margin of error, upset in the making, the lion's share. On the one hand, weighing options,
both sides of the aisle. And, of course, my favorite new cliche, sweetheart.
Okay. Now, but wait a second. But well, I think I'm with you. And I assume you believe, again, knowing you as I do, that this is a function of sloppiness on the part of reporters.
Or everybody, it's shorthand is what it is. Yeah, everybody knows what it means.
One would argue, is the plus of it. It is shorthand.
Yes, it is shorthand.
And immediately you know what people are talking about.
You do.
So isn't that that's an asset?
It is in some respects, but it's so tired. And we all love to use it. It's all like insider language, and everybody uses it. That's.
Are you guilty of this too?
Absolutely.
Oh.
Yeah.
Oh,
I love polls. Like, a lot of people trash polls. I love polls, so I'm one of those people. But
I think it's also if you're in broadcasting, it's the first phrase that comes into your head.
Is,
if you're a newspaper writer, you're under deadline pressure. It's the fastest way, the easiest way. I mean, to get the thing out. You know what other expression we always use? It's less common, but it will get as the election comes closer. The mo.
Yeah,
the momentum.
Who's got the big momentum?
Yeah. That's become a huge thing.
Yeah,
that's a new one.
That's funny because those ones kind of go in and out.
Yeah.
That one came up about a decade ago, and maybe now it's back.
Yeah, I don't know, but we talked about that in the
who's got momentum?
Yes, who's got momentum? That's always a big thing, yeah. But it's always fairly accurate in terms of who's going to win the race. If you get the momentum, you stand to win the race.
Yeah,
isn't
but so
true?
Can we get back to your basic premise here? Let's assume that your criticism is valid. I mean, it's not valid as – well, it is valid to a point. So it seems to me if you're going to criticize it, you need alternatives. And if you're guilty –
let's work on that.
Well, I know, but when are we getting – when are we getting alternatives?
We're going to work on those.
Okay, fine. Well, that's another expression, by the way.
A new cliche after you remold these.
Yeah, just call it a new day, I would say, is to give more importance than is merited to the results of the primaries. I mean, really.
Well, I mean, technically, it was a new day. There were people voted, about four of them, and then it was a new day the next day.
I mean, you might say, you could have said maybe it was a new day when the first time we elected an African-American president. That's a new day.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But now everybody said that it's not a new day because we're all mad at Obama. So it was a new day for a couple of days. And that went.
Actually, I do have an alternative for that, because you said you didn't come up with any, which is disappointing. What they should have said is, by the way, the primary happened yesterday. Nothing has changed. There's nothing to look forward to. We will offer nothing.
Well, Emily doesn't think there's a woman's vote either.
I don't.
No, I know.
I don't believe that.
That's why Deval Patrick beat Charlie Baker by 24 points, and in the and a poll out yesterday, another 24 point lead. What's that about?
The fact that Deval Patrick is a Democrat, maybe?
Well, wait a second. How about the fact that men, in virtually every race you look
at, a lot of women
overwhelmingly men support the Republican and overwhelmingly women support the Democrat.
Women are more liberal.
So that there is a women's vote.
I think women,
and there's a men's vote, too.
The issues that Democrats talk about resonate more with women.
Yeah,
I think that has to do with it, education kind of stuff.
When I'm talking about a women's vote, I'm talking about women voting for women. Like, somehow that's going to make the difference. Do women have similar philosophies about certain things?
But
this whole idea that there's a women's vote voting for women, I don't buy it.
Well, let me tell you, I would say two exceptions to that rule. I would argue that considering that we have one of the worst records in the United States of America and the most liberal state, or one of the most liberal states in America, I think women wanting a woman United States senator, I'm not taking anything away from Elizabeth Warren on the merits, I think that helped on the margins. And I would argue that there are going to be some people who are going to say after a lifetime of no women elected, obviously Jane Swift served but wasn't elected as governor. On the margins, a point or something, you don't think there's going to be a little tiny smidgen of the women's vote going to Coakley because they want a woman governor? Not if they violently disagree with it. You don't think so.
I don't.
You know what I was stunned by when we were doing research this week on some story, I forget which one it was, that in 2010, Martha Coakley only beat Scott Brown among women by 3 points. So the women's vote there.
Women turned on her.
They did. You know, every man in Massachusetts, as I've said a million times, was in love with Scott Brown. So apparently.
Including Jim Browdy, right?
And including Jim Browdy. It was
romance.
A romance of embarrassing proportions.
No, it was
we were
not.
All
I mean,
humiliated.
I know him. That's the extent
of
it.
Yeah, that's right. There was a texting going back and forth in this. Certain lilt in Jim's
that was till he abandoned me and moved to New Hampshire.
He did. He left you, Jim. But I mean, but it wasn't just. I mean, there was a certain hostility towards Scott Brown from some women because he reminded them of the boyfriend that dumped them back in high school or something. But obviously, lots of women abandoned their normal concern about those education issues, those the kind of welfare state issues.
They get swept up in the moment.
They get swept up by the barn coat, and that was that.
Okay. Emily.
Thank you.
It's been a pleasure.
Good.
Call
okay,
the Election
Emily,
Commission.
I'm going to.
And
call
we'll see
election.
What we can do on the intro. I know you are very unhappy about it, Emily. We want to keep you happy, so we'll work on it.
Bye.
Okay?
We'll be watching
Be Emily
Press. See Rooney Emily.
Emily joins us every Friday for Open Mic. You can keep up with her weeknights at 7 o'clock on Channel 2 for Greater Boston, and every Friday for my favorite show, Beat the Press. Emily, thanks a lot. Coming up, time for our Friday news quiz with the husband and wife duo behind Pretty Things Beer and Ale Project. This is 89.7 WGBH Boston Public Radio.
Welcome back to Boston Public Radio. I'm Jim Browdy. She is Marjorie. And it's time for our Friday news quiz here in Studio 3. Excuse me. Take on the week's headlines are Dan Paquette and Martha Holly Paquette. You may have concluded they are husband and wife. We ever had a husband and wife besides Myers and Chang ever?
I think this is only our second husband and wife.
Oh, Taza Chocolate. That's right.
Right. This is our third. Okay, this is the trifecta.
They're a husband and wife duo behind Pretty Things Beer and Ale Project. Dan, Martha, it is great to see you both. How are you?
Great. Thank you for having us.
Now, we're going to pretend that we're interested in talking to you to get to the point where you serve us your beer. So go ahead. Let's get through the talking really quickly.
Absolutely beautiful label. Describe the label on your beer there.
Sure. So that's Jack Doyle that you're holding. That's our flagship beer. And on the label is a little guy that most people think is a lemon. He's not a lemon.
I thought he was a lemon. What is he?
Looks like a lemon.
He's a grain of barley.
Oh.
Which is the main ingredient.
Yeah. Can I tell you, Martha, he's a lemon. So what is a gypsy brewer? What is up with that? What does that mean?
Well, the whole idea is if you've spent any time in the beer industry, you haven't made the riches to build a brewery. So we go and use people's excess capacity and make our own beer. So
you rent a brewery?
Yes.
Literally?
Yeah.
So you go there, I read it's like brew day or something, you do that thing, and then mm-hmm. what do they do? What happens at the place?
Well, the yeast does a lot for, so there's billions of yeast doing their thing, and then we sort of monitor the beer as it's fermenting, and then we do pay the brewery to package it because we would be there all day, every day, just doing packaging.
So how did you, tell people how you got into this whole thing. I mean, how did you wind up becoming gypsy beer brewers?
Well, you're the old hand, and she's the new kid. So
that's
why don't
right.
we start
you
with
you?
You
talked her into it,
okay.
From what I've read.
So I actually went to Emerson for journalism.
You did?
Yeah,
kids
you came to my
there.
Class one time.
She'll be a brewer. You did not. She came to your class?
Yeah, she did.
Martin?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. How was she?
She was great.
She was really great?
Well, was Chris Atwin your teacher?
Which I just can't, it's
teacher?
Been a long time.
Okay, whatever. Okay, so Marjorie came to your class, and so what
I
happened?
Gave a spectacular talk.
And, I graduated in the recession, and there weren't a lot of journalism jobs, and brewing seemed like a crazy idea, but I didn't have a job anyway, so I went for it here in Boston. I started interning in people's breweries, and the difference back then between a professional brewer and a non-professional brewer was about 2 months brewery job. So it was kind of easy for me to go from zero to two, and I just never gave up, in the late
90s. This is like 20 years ago, right?
Yeah, it's 22 years ago. Uh-huh. Late 90s, during the whole crash and all the breweries closed, there I was still going at it. And we moved to Martha and I moved to England, brewed in England for a bunch of years, and we came back and after 3 years and there was no work. Martha was a scientist. She came to Boston this first day looking for work, got a job at MIT. And we decided instead of using our leftover savings to buy IKEA furniture, we would brew one batch of beer and see what happened.
Is that really true?
Yeah, that's
true.
And
it was $9,000 to brew one batch of beer. I had no idea. I mean, how big is a batch?
That batch was, 20 barrels, which is like 40 kegs. So it's not a huge amount, and it was a big risk because if you can't sell that, then you're broke and you just have a bunch of beer, I guess.
Yeah.
Now, Martha, let me just say, for whatever it's rather cruel. You keep holding the opener, the bottles in front of you.
All right, let's
open
do it.
The beer.
Jim's had a tough week. He's been looking forward to this all week long. So did you sell? You did sell that first batch of beer, then?
We did. We were able to sell it by hook or by crook, partly because all our friends own bars.
So what am I drinking? I know the bottle has a lemon on it, but what am I? What are we drinking here,
I
Martha?
That.
So it's called Jack Doyle. It's our main beer, and it's a Saison, which is a Belgian style of beer.
Oh,
so it's very simple, golden, refreshing. And this has American hops in it, so you get some nice lemony, citrusy hops.
Okay, well, here's to the two of you.
Cheers. Thank you so much.
I'm gonna have one here, too.
That's delicious.
Oh, my God.
Thank you.
Forget the quiz.
That is delicious.
Oh, my goodness. Yeah. That is really
no,
good.
I'm not usually a big beer fan.
Uh-huh.
Wow.
Although I did get a big thrill. I went to Ireland for the first time in my life a couple of months ago and went to the Guinness factory, and I don't like Guinness.
Okay.
But when you get to the top and they give you the Guinness there and it's just made, it does taste totally different.
Mm-hmm.
And that was my first, you know, ignorant inkling about the different qualities of beers. I mean, this is a very different taste.
Very
it's
different.
Very
yeah.
good.
Yeah.
And by the way, we're going to start the quiz now, but just so it's clear, your website is prettybeer.com. But your business is Pretty Things.
That's
yes?
right.
Okay, fine.
There's a lot of pretty things out there in the internet world. So.
Excellent. Okay, well, we're going to find out how they find you and all. The beer is really good. Who do you want to ask first question of, Marjorie?
Why don't you start, Jim?
Okay. Whoa, that's I've never done that before.
It's okay. we're
okay, fine.
Dad.
Shouldn't mean she can't find her quiz. That's what that means. Dan, I'm going to start
okay.
with you. You ready?
Okay.
Here's David Letterman weighing in on one of the big news stories of the week. Here it is.
One of these trespassers made it all the way to the front door of the... When I heard this report, I just said, oh, for God's sakes, Hillary, wait your turn.
Okay, so where did this trespassing that David Letterman was talking about happen there, Dan?
That was at the White House.
That is exactly correct.
Very
That's an
good.
Excellent
We're
start.
Off to a
Thank
good start.
You very much.
Okay, Martha, you ready?
Okay, here we go.
Okay, a reality TV power couple finally get divorced this week. Here's Jimmy Kimmel talking about the newly single man from this busted relationship.
You know, I mean, when I was growing up, he was probably the most famous Olympic athlete in the world. His face was on a box of Wheaties. Now his face isn't even on his face anymore. Watch it, Michael Phelps.
Okay, which divorcee is Jimmy Kimmel talking about? Or divorced person is Jimmy Kimmel talking about, I should say.
Did I need to grow up in America to know this?
Well,
that's
actually,
true.
No.
That's a tough one,
no,
though.
But it's
no,
a
Martha
world
is,
kind of. He's a world kind of.
He's world
thing.
Famous.
He's
I
world
don't
famous.
Think so.
Yeah, he is. Do you know? Have any idea, Martha? Uh-oh. Do not look at your husband. That's the whole. It's a competition.
I really need to win this too.
Yeah. But, oh.
I don't.
You want to steal
it.
The question, Dan? Do you know it?
Yeah, I do know it. It's the American Mo Farah, right? It's Bruce Jenner.
That is exactly correct.
That's right. And he, you know, but it's good. He's evening the scales because usually everybody makes fun of the women's facelifts. It's nice and every once in a while I can make fun of the man's face and sort of even the scales.
By the way,
that
I hate it, but I don't even want to get into it. Okay, here's the next question. You can expand your lead there, Dan, over Martha. New York is having some major, major traffic issues this week. David Letterman yet again explains why. Here it is.
How about the traffic? Did anybody have to try and get around town yesterday or today? Oh, I'm telling you, it's crazy. It's because the is back in session and President Obama is in town. It's like Chris Christie. Every major artery is clogged.
Question okay. is, what event in New York City this week was causing those traffic headlines? Headaches. Excuse
headaches.
Me.
Yes, it's the United Nations General Assembly, is it?
Is that good
yeah.
enough?
Yeah.
Yes, the
yeah.
Climate Summit and the General
climate
Assembly.
Summit.
That
okay,
is
yeah,
very,
yeah.
very good. Now, Martha, how do you feel about the fact you're behind 3-0 at the
I
beginning?
I feel very bad.
You do,
I'm
don't
in trouble.
You? No, so let's talk to you for a second before you get to your question. You're the newbie on this thing. We heard you're a scientist. All that. So what's your connection to brewing? How did that happen? Other than him, we know that. But how did it happen?
Well, really, it started with drinking, which was, I guess, most people's avenue to brewing starts with drinking. I'm from England, and, you know, in England we have a real ale culture, that's what we call it. And so I've always loved beer and been interested in beer. But I wasn't a brewer, I was a scientist, totally, through and through, very sensible. And then I met Dan, and then it all went out the window.
You know, the beer pub bar culture is so different in England
it
than
really
it is, here.
Yeah.
Tell us.
I think, you know... You just a pub in England is a much more relaxed place. It's a place that lots of people go. They sort of gather to really be a community and like
yeah.
just bump into people. It's just a very social. It's really the hub of a community, and I love that about it. Bars here are much more. They're like go, sit down. Here's your server. What do you want to eat? Like, there's a lot more going on in a pub.
You're not really in control here in the pubs. You have a server, and you're probably expected to leave at some point.
Yeah, that's a great point. And it is I mean, it's like you know, the Cheers that was a big thing here for years. You know, this it's like in England. It seems like a lot of the bars are that everybody knows your name. To use the old cliche, but it does seem to be that way, which
yeah,
is kind of neat.
It is nice. It's different, but you know, it's
okay.
Yeah.
Marjorie for Martha.
You didn't like that line.
No, I liked it a lot. I did. But we want Martha to have an opportunity to catch up here.
Okay. Are we on what is, I'm going to hope I get this right.
Yeah.
What big event
yes.
is Stephen Colbert talking about here?
Environmental patients came out of their yurts to protest
in a place synonymous with nature, Midtown Manhattan.
An estimated 300,000 people marched through the streets of Manhattan for hours today for action to combat.
This was the largest protest in history.
Yes, hundreds of thousands of people lined the streets of New York for or were in line for the new iPhone.
Okay. Do you know what they were there about, what the march was about?
Was this the climate change summit?
That is absolutely correct. This was the march about climate change and fossil fuels. Very good.
By the way, Dan, what is this? I was reading about you guys from your website. What is a sour beer? I never heard of sour beer. What is that?
Well, you know, before yeast was, discovered, I guess, by Pasteur, there wasn't necessarily just one avenue towards fermentation. There's a lot of bacteria that fermented things. So just the same way that alcohol is a preservative, acid is a preservative. So, there were a lot of beers that were made and they would have a real sour characteristic coming from all sorts of bacteria.
Same as, you don't make a sour beer.
No, but
do you?
They do. But they're very popular. I used to make them maybe 15 years ago. But they're very popular, growing in popularity. If you don't know about it now, you will know about it soon because it's a big thing.
And Martha, how many? I'm sorry.
I was just going to ask Martha. Your main spot is down in Westport, Massachusetts. So this is a local operation all the way around. And what do they make in Westport? All sorts of different beers, or do they do the Gypsy Brewing like you guys do with a bunch of different people?
So we rent a brewery in Westport, and they make quite traditional beers. They make an IPA, they make a pale ale, they make a brown ale. So they're quite traditional brewers down there. And then we're not particularly crazy. We're a little more crazy than that.
How many varieties, how many different things do you do?
We do about 15 different beers a year.
You
so
do.
Like one a month, we're switching it up.
And other than the website, where are they? I mean, this is really good. Where do you find this out in the world? Where does one go, Dan?
Yeah.
Or Martha, go ahead. It doesn't matter.
In Massachusetts, we're in about 1,000 different locations. So usually where you can find good beer, you look for the larger format bottles, you'll find us. We're certainly at Whole Foods down the street. And
you
say you shop there at River Street.
I do all the time.
And many locations
I've actually
around
moved
here.
Into the store at River Street. I'm living there Wednesdays through Sundays.
It's a pretty good place to
saves a little money on the side. Okay, the score is, I think, 3-1, judges, at the end of two rounds. Dan, this is your next question. Here's Jimmy Fallon on a huge White House controversy.
President Obama, he's facing criticism over an incident yesterday where he was holding a in his hand, and he used that same hand to salute a Marine. Though with all that's going on in the world, I'm surprised he didn't salute with a bottle of Jack Daniels and a cigarette. And the other.
Okay, what was the president holding in his hand, Dan Paget?
It was a coffee cup.
That's exactly right. Even though that's what the stories say, but if you had read Matt Visor's story on coffee and politicians in the Boston Globe, he suggested that the guy does not drink coffee.
Tea drinker.
That he's a tea drinker. Does that worry you? The leader of the free world is only a tea drinker, Martha?
I think tea is absolutely the way to go.
Is that really so?
She's British.
I know.
She's
I forgot. Forget the question. Okay.
A little clotted cream on the side.
Why not?
Absolutely. Okay, here we go, Martha. The Discovery Channel announced it's rolling out a nutty new reality show called Rival Survival. It throws two groups of people who famously have had trouble cooperating onto a desert island, forcing them to work out the aisle to survive. Take a listen.
It's time to get to work and try to create some sort of a shelter.
I'll go cut a bunch of palm fronds, and let's figure out where the best overhang is.
There's a lot at stake here. It's really a pride thing. You don't want to be the one who's the laggard, the one who has to be taken care of.
Okay. Who are facing off in survival? Rival survival, I should say. They famously don't get along.
Hmm. Give a hint. They're working across the aisle. That's
they're working
the hint.
Across. They're trying to work across the aisle. Yeah, that's right.
So congressman?
That's
that
close.
Is that good enough, judges? Let's give her a break.
Yes,
she served
absolutely.
The beer. That's right.
Yes,
exactly.
It is. It's two contestants. They have two of the senators, Jeff Flake, a Republican, and Martin Heinrich, a Democrat. So I don't know. They think they need more people to make this a good show.
Let me, I'm looking at your two labels that are here. The other one is St. Patolphstown Rustic Brown Ale. Your labels are fabulous.
They are fabulous.
You like to think, I assume, particularly you guys, that what sells your beer is your beer. But I assume labeling, you have a huge smile on your face, is huge, right? To get people bought in and then hopefully it's the contents that keep them there. Is that Is that true, Martha? What's
totally.
The deal?
So me and Dan completely disagree about this. We just gave a talk this week at Northeastern University about,
really?
About design and beer. And he was like, oh, it's all about the beer. That's,
well, because he's
all
a brewer. I mean,
about.
That's exactly right.
And I was like, no. And so we designed the labels together. We draw everything on the labels ourselves. And so they're a really good reflection of the beer. So it's nice sort of link between the inside and outside of the bottle. And I think it's really important.
You don't really think... How can you say it's unimportant? I mean, why would you have a clever name if it didn't matter?
Yeah,
obviously,
and where
Dan,
did the name
wait a second.
Come
I'm grilling
from?
Dan here, please.
Okay.
We have the worst name ever for any beer in the history
you
of the world.
You did or do?
I think we do, yeah.
Pretty Things beer?
Because a man wouldn't buy it? Is that what you're worried about?
No, I mean, we wanted to create some creative space for ourselves because there's so many demons and devils, and we thought we'd be like Mary Poppins' own beer brand. And so we would always have that space to ourselves in the beer world, and it's been fun. But yeah, I'm sure people shake their heads at our beer. At
well,
our name.
How did you come up with Pretty Things?
Well, I mean, there's nothing more ridiculous than calling a beer pretty, right? So that was part of it. And actually, to be honest, we give a different answer every time we're
asked
that.
Okay.
Yeah,
so in other words, they don't know. So, so Martha, let me ask you before we go to the bonus round. So if Dan were in charge, as opposed to you, who obviously is in charge, it would be called Beer. Is that what the name of the company would be? Is that what it is?
Oh, I don't know what it would be called. Dan's Beer. Dan's Beer.
That's not very saleable.
Okay, let's go to the bonus round. Here's the premise of the bonus round today. Contestants, husband and wife, Dan and Martha Paquette. Since you're about craft beer, we're asking you about another kind of craft macaroni and cheese. You start with Dan.
Nice.
What's the score at the beginning of the bonus round, judges, please? Do you know? We don't know. Does anybody know what the score is in this thing? 4-2? 4-2, Dan,
okay.
Your head. Go ahead, you can widen your lead.
I always preface this by saying these are really hard multiple choice questions. Everyone gets them wrong, so don't worry about it. You will not have, you'll be totally guessing. Question. When were macaroni and cheese first sold together? A, during the Great Depression, a St. Louis salesman began to attach grated cheese to boxes of pasta with a rubber band. Or B, during the French Revolution, pasta and cheese were sold together on the streets of Paris as a cheap and hearty meal for rabble-rousers. Or C, during the Cold War, macaroni and powdered cheese were sold as the perfect food for your fallout bunker.
Wow. Yeah, I can see why you get it wrong.
yeah.
I don't know why you make food for rabble-rousers, so...
Dan, we're not asking for an essay. We're asking for an answer to the question.
Number one or A, whichever one that is.
A, you are correct.
Yay.
It was during the Great Depression. Oh. Absolutely. It's very good, Dan.
Now, your husband, you said it was... Why was it really important for you to win this thing, Martha? You said that before. Why did that matter? Why does it matter?
You know, we have a friendly rivalry.
I understand that. Well, you know, the good news for you, even though you're losing 5-2, totally by coincidence, this second question is worth 3 points.
Oh,
so you can tie it up. It just,
right.
Just so happens that way. Kraft macaroni and cheese owes its radioactive orange color to the dyes yellow 5 and yellow 6. Which of the following is an actual side effect from yellow 5 and yellow 6? A, jaundice. B, incontinence. And C, skin rashes. Is it jaundice, incontinence, or skin rashes? What's the answer?
Wow. Well, I'm hoping it's the last one because I think it sounds less.
It is tie. That is right. Skin rashes.
All right.
And by the way, also asthma, migraines, hyperactivity, which is why those dyes are not allowed to be used in Kraft products in Europe, Martha, by the way.
Oh, I remember that happening. I remember that happening.
God, that's awful.
Okay, here's the deal, Dan. If you get this right, you win. You get it wrong, you lose.
Okay.
That's the bottom line.
Okay,
here
we go, Dan.
Here comes a hard one.
Over the years, Kraft has released many special editions of macaroni and cheese in the shape of popular television characters. Which of the following is an actual special edition of Kraft macaroni and cheese? A, SpongeBob SquarePants. B, Teletubby, excuse me, or B, C, The Simpsons.
Oh, gosh, I thought I had it. I swear I ate a SpongeBob macaroni and cheese, so I'll say A.
You are correct.
Excellent.
That is unbelievable.
Yes. Okay.
Martha's not happy. That's pretty honest.
I'll buy her
so
a beer.
So you guys are becoming quite huge. So is the ultimate goal, we only have a minute left, Dan.
Right.
I mean this seriously. Is the ultimate goal when the money's there to buy a brewery, or are you happy doing what you're doing?
We
renting?
Love it.
Really?
We love it. Yeah, this is good. We get to work together. We don't grow too much. We hire employees. As you see, the whole company's in here. Seth is in the
one floor. Of our coworkers.
Yeah,
Seth is in here.
Yeah. That's the way we love it. It's a good life. And, you know, if we were much busier, we couldn't be here doing things like this. We did a beer festival in Tuscany a few weeks ago. That is the way to go, right?
It's a hard life.
Oh, a beer festival in Tuscany. Good
so
for
are
you.
So you happy? You only have 30 seconds. You moved from science to brewing beer. Was that a good choice for you, Martha? I mean, what's the deal?
I hate to say it, but it was. It was a great career
move.
Really?
Yeah. Oh, no. At MIT, even.
Yeah, maybe I was just a rubbish scientist. It's possible, isn't it?
Or maybe they're not much fun over there at MIT. I don't know.
Dan and Martha Paquette, you guys are great. And the beer, Pretty Things Beer and Ale Project, is fabulous.
Yeah,
thank
to
you.
Learn more great. About this fantastic beer we just ate or drank, oh. Go to prettybeer.com. That's prettybeer.com. Dan and Martha, thank you very much
for coming in. Brilliant.
And thank you all for listening to another edition of Boston Public Radio. Tune in Monday for Charlie Sennett. He's going to be joining us, calling in from northern Iraq. We're also going to have the two reverends in here for All Revved Up and journalist Lawrence Wright on the Middle East peace process. Our show is a production of WGBH, Boston Public Radio. Our production team is Chelsea Murris, Will Roslip, Amanda McGowan, Catherine Whalen, and our engineer today is Alan Mattis. I am Marjorie Egan.
And I am Jim Bradley.
Thank you so much for listening, and please tune in again on Monday for another 3-hour week, 11 to 2, Boston Public Radio. Have a great weekend. Bye.